Warriors, this is Andrew Marr, and today I wanted to talk to you guys about the book that we have coming out later this fall called Tales from the Blast Factory, and it's about my trial, my family's trial and experiences with the symptoms of traumatic brain injury, and then what it takes to pull yourself out of that and live a life of purpose and fulfillment. And why do TBIs matter? Well, they matter because close to 400,000 individuals have been diagnosed with a traumatic brain injury in the military since 2000 to 2015. Of that, up to 50% of those will develop a major mental disorder after diagnosis. And the conventional model has been psychotherapy and medication, which in most cases further exacerbates the problem. And it does that because it doesn't treat the underlying condition. And that's the basis of the book. We wanted to show what that life looks like, the life of an operator, what happens when disaster strikes and you step into the unknown and everything that you once knew is not the way it is anymore. And then we wanted to talk about and show the process of that healing process and talk about the Warrior Angels Foundation. And since then, we've brought that same level of healing that I've received to hundreds of others while delivering our message of hope and a viable solution to millions. And it was thinking, visualizing, and believing it in our minds first brought it into existence. And we wrote this book, my brother and I, Adam, so others could do the same thing. The name of the book is Tales from the Blast Factory. You can sign up to get on the pre-launch list. It'll get you all kinds of cool Warrior Soul bennies at www.talesfromtheblastfactory.com, and you can also pre-order on Amazon.com. That's Tales from the Blast Factory. You can pre-order on Amazon.com and talesfromtheblastfactory.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Dynatropin. Dynatropin is a 100% natural human growth hormone secretagogue. What is a human growth hormone secretagogue? Well, this is a mixture of nutrients that stimulates your own natural growth hormone production. Why is this important? Well, there's a lot of people out there who are not secreting growth hormone efficiently. And when you don't secrete growth hormone efficiently, what happens is a negative hormonal cascade that can disrupt almost every other hormonal process in your body. It can also really mess with your sleep, can mess with your overall health, your ability to burn fat, and your mental clarity. So Dynatropin was developed by one of the top interventional endocrinologists in the world as a method of stimulating growth hormone without injecting all that other crazy stuff that you see people putting into their bodies. With Dynatropin, you do not have to worry about any of the negative side effects that you would get with recombinant human growth hormone, and you can get all the benefits of optimizing your growth hormone. So if you're interested in optimizing your own natural growth hormone production, head over to www.warriorsoulagoji.com under fitness products and then supplements. You will find Dynatropin, the most effective human growth hormones secretagogue in the world.
What's going on, guys? Today we're bringing you a very interesting gentleman. Ryan Miller is a graduate of the United States Military Academy at West Point. He is a wounded veteran who lost his leg in Iraq and today is a graduate of the Harvard Business School and the Kennedy School of Government, who works in the cannabis industry, who actively advocates for and works to make the cannabis industry a bit more efficient. He's a really interesting guy, and we wanted to cover all aspects of his life. So this podcast is a bit long. And the reason why we wanted to do that is because we realize that there's a lot of you out there who are thinking about going into the military, those of you who are about to get out of the military, and those of you who have been out of the military for a while. And so we wanted to carry you through this story. And there's going to be particular aspects of this story that appeal to some of you. And then there's going to be other aspects of the story that, you know, many of you would be more interested in listening to. So if you're really interested in learning about West Point and learning about being a United States military officer or a soldier operating in theater, then definitely check out the first hour. If you're interested in learning about cannabis and its value for veterans and its and the industry aspect of cannabis, definitely listen to the second hour. But in all, this is an absolutely amazing story about a veteran who was wounded, who lost a leg, and who persevered to find his purpose in life. And regardless of whether we come back with all of our limbs and not a scratch on our body, or if we come back injured, we all have to do that. We all have to find our purpose and transform into what we need to become in order to live our best lives. And Ryan's done that. So he's a huge inspiration, and I hope that regardless of what part of this episode you listen to, or if you listen to the whole thing, that you catch a lot of the different lessons that are in here. So with that, no longer will delay you from getting into episode number 48 of the Warrior Soul podcast with Ryan Miller. This is Chris Albert, and I'm here to remind you of one thing. Someday, you're going to die. Now, that's not some morbid statement or scary idea. It's a solid fact. Your time here on this earth is limited. And you need to be reminded of this as much as possible for one simple reason. To live your best life while you can. This is the Warrior Soul Podcast. One. Good afternoon or morning or evening or wherever you are, whatever time it is. Welcome to the Warrior Soul Podcast. We are here today with Ryan Miller. Ryan, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. How you guys doing?
Outstanding. Outstanding. Andrew, how you doing over there?
Oh, doing wonderful. We were chatting here with Ryan about some of his dealings with the VA and how it works if you can be a full-time patient, but maybe not so much if you actually run a life and a business and other things. But thought it was some interesting conversation, so we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, Ryan has an extremely interesting background. U.S. military veteran and, you know, survivor. Ryan, can you give us give everybody out there in the audience a little bit about your history and your background?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. So first of all, thank you guys so much for having me on. This is a great podcast. I just discovered it recently through Kevin Fleck, who you interviewed. Great interview. He's a buddy of mine. So again, just want to thank you for allowing me to get out there and tell my story. And hopefully too, you know, we'll get into some of my cannabis advocacy. So this, you know, any opportunity I get to, advocate for that, especially on behalf of veterans, is an incredible opportunity. So again, I really appreciate it. Yeah. A little bit about me. I, you know, born and raised in New York City. I actually went to high school about 5 minutes from the Trade Center. Interestingly enough, I played football in high school in our, again, you can imagine an urban high school in downtown Manhattan. You know, we used any basically open field at times to practice. So there were times during summer training, I mean, we were literally practicing in the shadows of the Twin Towers. So I graduated in 2001 from there shortly before those towers fell and started West Point. Yeah, it was September 11th, obviously, plebe year at West Point. already a crazy enough time. And to add to that, you know, my hometown's attacked, not just my hometown, I mean, my neighborhood almost, where I went to high school in downtown Manhattan. So obviously
that's got to be a completely different feeling and experience than most of us that we had, you know, no geographical alignment, you know, other than belonging to the country and feeling connected that way. But I mean, that's where you grew up. That's what you knew. That was your neighborhood, man. What was that like in September at West Point, getting that news and then reliving it remotely?
Yeah, and this is really interesting. And I'm from Staten Island. So Staten Island is where most of or a large proportion of the first responders, cops and firemen, Port Authority cops that, you know, a lot of whom lost their lives are from. So, I mean, I know folks that died. My mother knew a lot of people. She's in the running community there. So a lot of firemen in the running community. So it was pretty tough. But ironically, I think, you know, being at West Point, considering it is more than any other academic institution, you know, probably on par, of course, with Navy and some of the other service academies, you know, the students at that school were more affected by 9/11 than any other school out there. And if you came to that campus, other than a slightly increased security presence, you would have thought nothing happened that day. You would have had no idea that every individual at that institution's lives had changed dramatically that day. And that's a big credit to West Point and this kind of culture, the military culture of understanding that, hey, we have to be able to compartmentalize these really horrific events, and we have to be able to continue the mission. And I'll never forget that the morning of September 11th, I actually had chemistry at a chemistry lab that morning. I had the hour before off, and I remember it was one of those, we had to, once a week, we'd have to take apart our bed just to force us to make it as part of an inspection. And making the bed was kind of a pain in the butt. Eventually, you could get it. It literally took about 20 minutes if you were doing it right, and that's when you kind of had it down. So by this point, it would take you forever. So I remember I'm sitting there making my bed, and then I kind of did this. It was something we would do, especially as freshmen, in the AM inspection period. So basically, I think until noon, you weren't allowed to sleep in your room. You had to have your door open, ready for inspection at any time. You know, kind of a thing we did was we'd make our bed and then kind of lay on it while finish making it. And we might drift off for a couple of minutes. That's how we catch a few minutes of sleep. So I remember drifting off and waking up, and you just hope nobody comes in and then, you know, bust your chops for doing it. I remember someone running down the hall screaming, you know, turn the TV on. Just like a central kind of desk area, in the company area, kind of how West Point's divided out. And I overheard something about a plane hitting the Trade Center. And I'm thinking, I think a small plane had hit the Empire State Building many years ago, you know, did some damage, but it wasn't a big deal. And that's what I assumed had happened. So, you know, I'm assuming lives had been lost and, you know, this is some kind of small tragedy, but it honestly didn't even, you know, if it wasn't for the fact that it was from New York, frankly, I probably wouldn't have even really thought too much about it. I get my gear ready. I walk over to the chemistry building, and again, it's weird. People are kind of talking and, you know, in like pairs as they're walking. I'm a freshman, so I'm not talking to anybody. I'm, you know, head and eyes straight forward, just getting to the chemistry. But I keep hearing stuff about plane, and then I heard some say terrorist. You know, and like it was just a short 5 minute walk to the building. And then I got into the classroom, and you know, we saw the reality of the situation. Our teacher, who was a old school, he's a lieutenant colonel at the time. So I think he was post-Vietnam, but I think he had actually been involved in some of, in Just Cause. I think he was in the Rangers at some point. So, you know, he had been involved in some actual, you know, combat in the 90s and certainly Gulf or Desert Storm. And, you know, we sat there for the first 5 minutes watching, you know, I'm watching these buildings. It's surreal. I think it was so powerful that I really just didn't really feel any emotions, to be quite honest. I mean, I guess technically that's shock or something. And I remember telling a kid, and I barely knew this guy because it was pretty early on the school year, next to me, that I went to the high, there's my high school. You couldn't see the school, but there's a bridge. It's pretty famous in a lot of the depictions of 9/11. There's like a steel arch, a white steel arch bridge. It goes over West Side Highway. So that's what actually connected my school to, you know, kind of the other side of that pretty busy road. And again, I'm in shock, and I'll never forget, though, our teacher saying, All right, everybody, your lives have been changed dramatically today, but we have a chemistry lab we have to execute, so we need to get downstairs and do that. And I remember my biggest concern suddenly was, oh, shit, I forgot my lab goggles. I have to go run back to my room. I hope no one busts my balls on the way out there and back. I mean, that's, you know, that's kind of West Point where you're just so focused, you're able to compartmentalize and focused on the mission. And essentially, that's what they were teaching us. Was, you know, one day, and this held very true, you know, one day, 5, 6, 7, 8 years later, you're going to be in war zone and you're going to lose that, you know, that key member of your platoon, that guy that kind of everyone rallied around, a funny guy. You know, what happens when you lose that soldier? You know, you're going to have to go out there and perform and execute the next day. So you have to be able to kind of, you know, focus on the mission, compartmentalize things, and you know, find ways to, you know, ultimately, you know, deal with the tragedy of what happened.
So that was such an interesting time to be in the military, as far as things go. And I can imagine a really interesting time to be at West Point, as you said. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm from Fairfield County, Connecticut myself, and we lost a lot of people in the towers. And, you know, I remember at the time I'd enlisted in the Marine Corps in 1999. And that was the Clinton years, you know, and we hadn't had a major combat operation or anything like that, you know, in those years prior. You know, there was a few blowups and things like that. But, you know, that institutional knowledge or feeling of what it's like to be attacked is largely gone, you know, lost in history. When you guys, for the rest of the time you were at West Point, was there this feeling of preparation from that day on, or did it take some time to ramp up?
Absolutely. No, I think as soon as that happened, and again, it goes to the irony of how that night, like I said, I mean, I remember getting my balls busted by a senior who wanted me and some other freshmen to throw, we call them birthday parties. So it's like, in theory, it's the one chance you get to get back an upperclassman on their birthday. You go, you know, mess with them in the middle of the night, you know, throw some stuff in their room, you know, click by trying to think of some weird stuff we did, drag them out, throw them in the shower if they're too drunk, stuff like that. And this guy was yelling at us like, you better have a birthday party for my roommate tonight or, you know, or else. And to be honest, we didn't do the birthday party. You know, things were trying to normalize things. We didn't want to normalize them that much. Unfortunately, wisely, the kid realized it wasn't going to look good if he, you know, started jamming us up for not throwing his roommate a birthday party in the night of September 11th. But yeah, I think it was subconsciously, I mean, we all like an extra switch was hit. I actually know people, is what's interesting. I know people who were on the fence, and you know, I've talked to them subsequently about West Point, you know, early on in their freshman year, even their sophomore year, that wound up staying and graduating because of 9/11. So, yeah, I think it had effect that there was definitely a slightly more serious tone. And again, it's really hard to compare because I was only there for a couple of months before 9/11, but, you know, maybe the serious tone always existed, but I could tell, I think there was, even with my little bit of experience pre 9/11 at West Point, there was a different atmosphere there. And then very quickly, I mean, that, I think by January I had Jason Amerine and, goodness, I can't remember the other Green Beret team leader's name, came to us from basically, you know, right from the field to, they were, Jason Amerine is pretty well known. He was Karzai's bodyguard / confidant / again, military advisor, strategic advisor, connection to the West, all these different things, and this was pretty cool as a, you know, like a, I think not even 30-year-old, special forces captain. And they were able to bring these guys. I mean, they were bringing these folks back to talk to us when it was still fresh. And I was actually really, really, really lucky to have Jason Amerine as my international relations teacher a couple of years later. So I got to know a lot more of his story and of the, I think it's one of the greatest successes in modern warfare that unfortunately is going to get forgotten in history because of what happened after it. But, you know, how a small detachment of Green Berets and I think, you know, some Marines and some other support folks were out there too. But basically overthrew the Taliban in a couple of months. And again, unfortunately, after that, great success. Things changed a little bit after that.
Yeah, we definitely have the blueprint on how to execute that and overthrow. It's setting up stability across the land afterward. It seems to be the issue. But Ryan, speak about what that was like to be early on in your career at West Point and having the most experienced and battle-hardened, you know, people coming off of the front lines, coming back, getting shaved, cleaned up to West Point, and you getting delivered firsthand information. How did that impact you as a leader and your future career?
I mean, obviously, it's going to do a couple of things. I mean, it's going to inspire the hell out of you. You know, I would try, and I think most cadets, you know, would obviously take any opportunity to see these individuals when they came back. And again, West Point was really good about bringing these folks back. So A, you know, it was inspirational. So whether it was, and again, West Point's a tough place. I actually, in retrospect, really, I actually enjoyed West Point, as sick as that sounds for any of my classmates or anyone at West Point is listening.
You'd be one of the few people I've ever heard to say that, sir.
And I think it goes to the fact that yes, it's very superficially, it's tough. There's the, and not just for military standards, the academic standards, the academics are very challenging at West Point. Now, I will say I did avoid getting in trouble. So if you know, the people out there have walked hundreds of hours, that's kind of our little internal punishment. And that's a whole other story to talk about what those are. If people got in trouble, then yeah, West Point could really, really suck. But for me, again, I kept my head under the radar. And what I really just appreciated it in retrospect is that, again, just close tribal nation, close tribal kind of culture that exists there, and that obviously exists in the military as well. And that's why I think, you know, folks in environments like that, I actually think it's one of the most mentally healthy environments, and one of the most highest degrees of mental health of any school out there. Because yes, on the surface it sucks, but then you have 4,000 other people going through this suck with you, and again, like deep down inside, you actually feel really good because you feel like part of a group and a team and you feel supported. Again, you might be sitting there, and I remember Saturday nights, freshman year, sitting there with, you know, four other dudes, watching movies on a little 15-inch monitor, complaining about how our friends were getting drunk and, you know, getting laid and doing all kinds of crazy partying at school, or even get to just sleep in, little things like that. And we'd sit there and complain about it and cry about it. But honestly, I would trade those, because I did things like that in business school. I tried to make up for it years later, and I didn't find it particularly rewarding. And those conversations, because, yeah, there'd be a lot of bitching, but, you know, eventually you'd get some really, really great, deep insights, and you learn a lot about your fellow cadets and your fellow brothers and sisters there through these very intimate, you know, small group, essentially meetings. And I value that infinitely more than any kind of typical social college experience. And that's, again, one of the reasons that, if I heard myself saying this at the time, because again, it is superficial to suck, but it's a pretty strong superficial. I thought you'd be crazy, but, yeah, in retrospect, I really enjoyed my time there. And I
drank my ass off throughout my 20s and, so you definitely weren't missing anything there.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, I tried to make up for it in grad school, and I did go to, business school, which in general, a large component, you know, there's an academic component and there's a heavy social networking and drinking component. And, I wish now, and, you know, I had kind of treated it more again, like West Point, than, you know, then.
Well, I want to get into grad school, but a couple more things I want to talk about West Point. One, what led you to, as a young man, a teenager, to say, I want to go that route, and what did you have to do to get accepted? And then the second part, Ryan, is what would you recommend to somebody else who today is trying to get into West Point? What should they be crafting, you know, their life like to achieve that goal?
Okay, great question. Hopefully I can answer this decently because it's been a while, but at least the second part there. But for me personally, you know, I was pretty fortunate. I was born with a good head on my shoulders. I got into a very good high school. Again, the one we were talking about earlier that was in downtown Manhattan there, just 5 minutes from the Trade Center. And, you know, I kind of enjoyed it, but I was a football player. I really defined myself at that time as a football player. And I always tried, I think I always kind of just wanted to be slightly different than everybody else. So this was an academic school. I never really took, I didn't get as competitive as some other folks in academics. So I actually technically graduated in the bottom half of my class, but this is a school where I have 600 kids, 200 are going to Ivy Leagues and Stanford's and MIT's out there. And yeah, that's the thing is you had all these kids going to these great schools. I couldn't get into any of those great schools because I didn't take academics as seriously, and I was focused more on football in high school. But West Point, by doing that, West Point was actually perfect because, again, I had the head on my shoulders. I had leadership experience. I had physical toughness and, you know, physical fitness. So I'd say about sophomore year when I started looking around me, that's when it kind of got into my head. And my father actually passed away my sophomore year of high school. And my uncle, who I went to West Point, I saw some strength in him. And I think really, actually, it's probably my father's passing that initially kind of set that idea in my head that this is something you need to seriously look into and consider. And then over the rest of sophomore year, I kind of started exploring, hey, what does this process look like? Because it is a more involved process than a typical college application. Personally, to me, I thought it was a lot more enjoyable because it was a lot of variety of little things. It wasn't, you know, the essays were actually, they limited you to a handwritten essay of five lines or a response for like these three questions. It was perfect because I'm not a great writer. My father passing, seeing the strength of my uncle, who was a 72 grad. And then when I realized too, you know, I had a sister, so we had, you know, some money from my father's passing, she can now go wherever she wanted to for free because she gets all the money for school. And then the real kind of, I think the main driver, the kind of personal, almost selfish reason is I just wanted to be different than everybody else in my high school. And this is 2000, 2001. This is like we were talking, you know, the end of the Clinton years there. The concept of some kind of foreign conflict, of being involved in war, it was bizarre. I remember through the process of educating myself on West Point in the military, and my uncle was very good about, you know, propagandizing me in a sense. And he's just giving me book after book. So I'm reading Once an Eagle. I'm reading Killer Angels. I'm reading, you know, all these books throughout history that involve great military leaders and mostly, you know, a lot of times great West Pointers. And, you know, it really steeled my resolve that this is the path I want to take my life. But what was interesting is while I'm reading this, especially I remember reading about the class of 66 in Vietnam, Long Gray Lines, the book, and saying, wow, this is crazy. I'll never experience anything like this.
I read that book. That book was absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Really, really great book.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, the classes of like 04 and 05, and I mean, actually, any of the classes of the past 20 years at West Point, you know, we've got stories that, and an overall class story, I think, that can certainly hold a candle, even the class of 66 in Vietnam.
Yeah, that's, you know, that book was, you think about the classes who involved conflict. And, you know, I came up in those years myself as an enlisted person. And you know, war was like almost this, you know, we trained for war. We talked about war a lot. But the idea of the United States getting into an actual ground conflict was almost foreign to most people outside of the military. Nobody could conceive of it. And nobody thought it would ever happen.
Exactly. And you know, it's funny, we still were training for a conflict, but it was a big ground conflict, but it was still the Fold the Gap or jungle warfare, you know?
Yep. I remember doing call for fire exercises on this computer image of the Fold the Gap, and it was the Russians are coming through.
Well, they might have to dust some of that off, but that's another story.
Yeah, they're probably dusting that off right now. So you're coming through, you get through West Point, and then you're heading into your Army career. Mm-hmm. And you graduated, what was it, probably 2004, 2005?
Graduated 2005.
2005. On that day, what was your feeling like as you were heading off into your military career?
It's funny because I think I always said grad week's a very busy week at West Point for all the classes. And I remember saying the first 3 years, oh, grad week, my senior year is going to be great. And it was the worst one. It's just that much bitter. So if you want to ask specifically how I was feeling the day of graduation, I just wanted to get things over with. But in all seriousness, I think actually what I and some of my friends did is we recognized that this was just a very, I mean, this was a huge, huge accomplishment, but it really was a start. But we really needed to take that time in the next, you know, week or two and just focus on enjoying, you know, that accomplishment, that great accomplishment, even though there was much, much more growth and learning and challenges and things like that to come. So yeah, I'd say around the time of graduation, everybody just, you just focus on the present. So that was a very, very good time, enjoyable time. I would say, yeah, it was probably as I started to get ready I was an infantry officer. So I went down to Fort Benning. I started in, I think, July or August. The great thing about that was it was like a class reunion. So, you know, you're going for, by the time I'm starting to find, you know, my leave, you have about up to 60 days before you start your first unit of leave to take. I was really looking forward to getting back and not just getting back into my profession and my job and learning a lot. And IOBC is a lot of fun with Infantry Officer Basic Course. They kind of changed things around. But it was a lot of fun, and you were there. It was like, and not only was it a reunion, it was most of the kids that you enjoyed hanging out with the most that you are now, you know, spending all day with. And it was different than West Point in that, you know, you were still in kind of a training environment, but you were given a little bit, you know, you were treated like an adult a little bit more. So it was really nice to kind of have that great experience of training together, going through hardship together, but at the same time, like at West Point, at the end of the day, you know, you're still in the Army at the end of the day, but you're also now an adult, which was nice. I know that kind of sounds weird.
Know infantry officer is a, you know, highly sought after position and field. So why do you think you were picked to go infantry? What was the is there a story behind that?
Oh, I mean, I just picked it. No, so I, you know, at West Point, the way it works is there's two big decisions you make your senior year. Your first is your branch. And then, you know, after everyone's branch is determined, you kind of break down a few months later and then you pick your post. And it's all based on class rank. So to be totally honest, I mean, I did really well at West Point. I knew as far as branch, I was going to get whatever I wanted. And actually, I was telling someone recently is peer pressure. I don't like the way, though, like, I think people, the connotation that implies. Most of my friends were just, I mean, most, the largest branch that in the military, as far as officers go, or you know, military officer, well, actually, correction. I'm not exactly sure what the largest, but I'm sure there's like acquisitions or something is huge. But as far as West Pointers going into the military, the number one branch as far as number of personnel is infantry. They have the most slots. So it wasn't like super competitive. This is what my good friends, my core peer group is doing. I actually really enjoy this. When I started coming from New York City, being a kid from New York City that, you know, thought the great outdoors was the, you know, half acre lot of swamp land that just hadn't been developed yet down the street. It was a little different. It was a little adjustment, but yeah, I mean, I loved just running around the woods, loved fighting, loved all those kind of aspects. And again, the camaraderie that you get when your main focus is leading individuals as opposed to kind of figuring out, I mean, and you're using technology, but you know, you're not managing technology, you're managing people at the end of the day. And I think it's just a lot more rewarding and enjoyable. So that's essentially how I you know, picked my branch. I think probably, I honestly would say probably from the beginning of junior year on, I knew I was going to go infantry. So it wasn't really a big, to be honest, it wasn't like a big decision or anything. I mean, literally I just sat there and, you know, the day your day you have to pick, you go onto the, you know, it's like an internal, little internal website and you have to rank all 16 branches that are available from 1 to 16. So it was infantry. And then after that, I knew I was going to get infantry. I can't remember what I put. Not a big surprise. And then branch, what did surprise me was at the time slightly, I guess, disappointing. I thought I had planned on going to Hawaii. I knew I was going to go infantry in Hawaii. That's actually what my uncle did. And I think since Hawaii had bases out there, my rank was high enough to have gotten me Hawaii. Because it's what you do on post night is everyone who's in that branch, so you get all like, it's about 220 infantry, you know, future infantry officers. So again, 220 out of like 900 just shows you how big infantry was as a branch within the school. And from the top ranked kid all the way to the bottom, you go up one at a, your name's called, you go up there and you take your name tape and you put it, you know, if there's an open slot, they basically put all the slots at the different posts out there and you just put your name on a slot. And then obviously once the slots are done, that post is closed out. Yeah, any of the past, and historically I would have gotten Hawaii, and we did a mock draft, not draft for lack of bread, about a couple of days before. And I was like, oh crap, I didn't get Hawaii. This is not good. So I had to figure out pretty quickly what, where I was going to wind up and what I was going to do. I did not get Hawaii. I was still hopeful I didn't get Hawaii, but I wound up picking Fort Lewis. And interestingly enough, my choice was between Fort Lewis, Washington, and Germany. And I picked Fort Lewis and wound up in Germany anyway because my unit moved over there. And I'm super, super fortunate and grateful I got to experience both locations, Tacoma and Fort Lewis. Great units up there, great posts, just a great place to live. And then living in Germany, having the opportunity to live out there was phenomenal for a year. And they were really good, even though we were training. It did two things. It actually reset my unit's training cycle, so we got an extra like 8 or 9 months of training. I mean, we lost a couple of that in the move. But that's huge, you know, to come off a year on, year off, and actually be able to build the team out a little bit more, having a little bit extra time to build your team out, bring new people on, train them up, go through again two full training cycles. That was huge. But also they were really good in Germany about giving soldiers kind of time for both their families or to travel. So we had like one 3 day and one 4 day a month, basically, that USER, you know, the U.S. Army Europe would give us. So we were working hard, but we were playing pretty hard too. And that was a tremendous opportunity and a great year.
Ryan, cool. Real quick, there's so much stuff here I want to get into, but this idea of being a second lieutenant fresh out of West Point, coming into command, I'm sure some of your soldiers had some inferior experience. What was that like? Walking in that first day and being like, hey, I'm you know, second lieutenant Miller, straight out of West Point. You know, what was that like, and how was your reception from, you know, your non-commissioned officer?
I'm one of those cases where I had to fire my first platoon sergeant. And it's always funny when the lieutenant who doesn't know what the hell they're doing, you know, is, and it's really like you and the first sergeant commander are kind of doing it. So yeah, I showed up to my unit. I was pretty nervous. I think most of us are. You want to make a good impression. My main fear, and I think it's all our main fear, is just letting these folks down. So kind of nervous about that. Also nervous about perceptions, West Point thing. I think most soldiers in the military, and again, you get phenomenal offers from West Point, ROTC everywhere. I think most, though, understand the value, you know, of the fact that an individual went to West Point. We do actually, compared to our ROTC guys, we just happen to be fortunate enough to have a lot more opportunities to train. I mean, this is a military academy. So not only train, but live in a kind of very highly kind of sport and disciplined lifestyle. So that I think sometimes, shows, and I think even though they bust our chops, soldiers are going to give you, or whatever you're from, officers period coming in, soldiers are going to give you the benefit of the doubt. It might not seem that way, but they are going to give you the benefit of the doubt. So again, I showed up, I think we go through the mock talk you give to your, platoon. We do that a whole bunch of times in officer basic course and kind of how you approach that first day. So actually in the beginning, you get to the unit and I think for about a week, you're kind of put on staff. Some people are go straight down to the unit. With ours, they wanted to at least get situated a little bit. So these folks kind of saw me around for a week and a half. And then I individually met with some of the squad leaders. Actually, I think that's a really good way to do it. Is meet one-on-one your platoon sergeant and then try to go around and meet one-on-one with your squad leaders before you, and very informal. The formal talk, the formal counseling and all that stuff, that can come later. But if you just approach and say, hey, let's sit down or let's grab lunch or something like that, I think that's pretty helpful to at least, you know, when you're standing up there in front of your unit the first time, you know, your subordinate leaders aren't also hearing you for the first time with their soldiers. So if they have and you already have built that relationship, it's almost like they're going to pay attention a little bit more and they're going to have like look at you differently while you're standing there in front of formation. And it's whether it's other soldiers seeing us or just feeling an energy, I think they'll take it a little bit more seriously. So that's a little random little technique I recommend out there. But yeah, I honestly can't even remember what the heck I said. I said it was my honor to lead these guys. And to be quite honest, it was nothing particularly enlightened or anything like that. It was pretty standard. But you do that and then you just have to really rely on those, on your squad leaders and your platoon sergeant. And some people want to like get out there and charge from the front. Now, I'm not saying that's the wrong way to do it, but you have to be the type. There's very few people that can just get out there and just start leading a brand new unit that they have no relationship with and be really successful. Those are the greatest leaders in the world are able to do that, but the average person isn't. So really, just slowly kind of build credibility, listen a lot, was it 2 to 1, 2 years, 1 mouth? Well, pretend you have about 50 years and, half a mouth, in the beginning. The only time you really should be calling anything out those first few months while you're figuring things is if you see a outright moral ethical issue, then, it's your responsibility, of course, to stomp that out immediately. But even if you see some things kind of going the wrong way, as long as there's not a safety issue, don't immediately kind of jump in there and try to be the hero and fix everything. Understand why, even if it's the wrong way, understand why did they think to use this technique? Is it just something that everybody's been doing forever? Or was it a solution to a problem that might have changed right now? And these folks don't realize that the problem has slightly changed. So there's, could be a better solution. So really the point is, and I kind of knew this and I did an okay job of it. I wasn't the greatest PL out there, but, my advice is just listen, and try to build one-on-one relationships and then a team relationship with your subordinate leaders.
But you said you had to fire the platoon sergeant. Okay. So I'm interested to hear that story and what led to that.
So, again, he was a nice guy. The Army, weird stuff would happen in the Army and personnel. This was a guy who had never actually been a combat infantry. He was an infantryman. He had started off as a cook and then somehow found his way in infantry and then went to had a basic training detail. And I guess he was a half decent DI on the surface, even though his wife was one of his former students there. He was weak. He was physically weak. And I don't know how the hell he made E7 or EA, excuse me, E7. I don't know how he slipped through the cracks, having never actually, I don't think he was ever even a squad leader other than basic training. Basically, someone kind of slipped through the cracks, probably gave him a chance, was in the right place, right time. Truthfully, he didn't want to do it. He can't admit that though. Couldn't really do it. Nobody took him very seriously. And in retrospect, that really is so important for the young PL. I mean, the most important, so that we talked about what you can do, but the most important thing that should be happening is your platoon sergeant should be, really your primary instructor in like life for the first few months when you get to your platoon. You should just defer to, most of it, again, moral, ethical or gross incompetencies. They're supposed to be the one that you're going to really lean on while you're learning that job and building credibility within the unit. So when you don't have that's pretty tough. And it became quickly apparent that, this was not just affecting, forget my development, but, my platoons. And we were able to make a transition, and brought in somebody else and, sent him out in the Army. You don't actually get fired. You just move somewhere else, into a job on staff that I think he actually performed fairly well at. So he was happy there. Ended his career, but to be honest, I don't want this guy to be an E8. He's already an E7 somehow. I remember talking to my first sergeant and my company commander, and we, you know, collectively, and it's awkward for me because I am still in this, again, I'm trying to be in this listen mode, and trying to give him the benefit of that. And I find myself oddly defending this guy, maybe this weird sense of like platoon loyalty. Not, I knew he had to transition out, but trying to, you know, at least minimize the blow to this guy, when it happened. But yeah, transitioned him out, got in a new platoon sergeant. It was really weird then because now me, who didn't know what they were doing and honestly probably hadn't really developed the full, because this is just about 2 months in, developed the trust and detail, you know, the relationship as I eventually did or wanted to see it with my platoon as a general in general. But now, you know, this new platoon sergeant comes in and I'm like the old guard. So people are kind of like trying to play dad off mom now, coming to me and trying to go around. It was a real weird situation. It was a challenge, but I think in the end I learned a lot, even though the specifics now it's I don't know, 15 or 10, 12, whatever years ago. I don't remember the details anymore, but yeah.
Sure. So transitioning into your combat time, kind of set the stage for us there. What was it like in Iraq? What was it like training for it? And then talk about getting on the ground and the experiences that happened shortly after.
Yeah, so we deployed to Iraq from Germany. Again, we were fortunate enough. We had two full, and a training cycle, for those who know, is, you know, in the military, when you're training for, especially, you know, when you're training for war now, so you actually have an event, that's a real event, tangible event to train for, typically you start with individual skills. So, you know, you're qualifying on your weapons, learning how to use them, and then you're moving into small teams. So you start with squad, and then you just keep adding more elements on until you eventually, as a full big fighting unit, a battalion or a regiment or a brigade, whatever, what have you, you go out to a training center, you know, offsite somewhere, big area, and do mock 2 weeks of battle. So we got to do that twice. So that was incredible. And what was lucky for us too is where we were based in Germany, we essentially were at the training center. So we would go into our backyard, go out, do our training. And there were some nights where we would get done and we were supposed to bivouac or crash out in the training area. And this was another lesson, you know, I'm saying, no, heck yeah, we're going to stay out here all night. You know, we're tough, we're infantry soldiers. And, you know, you don't, common sense, again, this is the second platoon trying to pull me aside and said, no, this is not going to actually have any effect on if we're tough or not. These people are going to go to Iraq. They're going to be away from their families for 15 months. We give them every opportunity. It's not going to soften them up. So that was great when I kind of realized that, you know, you can be tough, but, you know, you also have to understand that they are making huge sacrifices already. So anytime you're able to give somebody a little bit back, one of your soldiers a little bit back, is great. So yeah, phenomenal training up. I mean, I thought we were super well trained. We had the team that went to fight in Iraq had, you know, again, trained together for a while. So yeah, we went over there July of 2007. It was a interesting time. It was during the beginning of the surge. So we deployed to Baghdad, Iraq, and we were a striker unit. And strikers for, I don't know how the listeners are, or I don't know how familiar they are, but it's a primarily designed to carry a bunch of people, infantry carrier vehicle. There's a whole bunch of different variants. It's a really cool platform. I mean, there's one with a, you know, basically a tank cannon on it. There's one that shoots TOW missiles and stuff. There's one that's for medical evacuations. But the main one is a big eight-wheeled vehicle. If you've seen the news, in war zones, particularly Iraq, in urban environments, you'll see this giant eight-wheeled vehicle with this metal cage around it and usually like this tent-looking thing on the top of it. So that's a striker. And they're just an amazing, amazing asset because you can really, I mean, you can pack that thing full of personnel. It has a remote weapon system on top, so you can actually sit inside and the gunner can fire from the protection of inside the vehicle. And lastly, it is an incredibly survivable vehicle. I saw one of these take a massive, massive deep buried IED, something that would have literally just disintegrated a Humvee. And this striker was able to self-recover back to base, even though it had like two axles dragging and, you know, four wheels completely blown off. I mean, that's how survival, and everybody walked away from that without a scratch. Although, you know, long term, who knows with the concussive damage. So yeah, we were we got over there and very quickly were sent to, you know, all four corners of Baghdad, basically. My company was detached from our battalion and attached to some unit in Kark, which is just north of the green zone there. And we did civilian and reconstruction operations, so non-kinetic operations for a little bit, which was cool. We had other units at that time in Sadr fighting. We had other units down in Bayop just kind of sitting around. But by October of 2007, again, surges in peak were actually turning the tide. I think three things really turned the tide in Iraq. I mean, one was just the fact that the surge, you had just shit ton of bodies over there. Prior to that, we play a lot of whack-a-mole, where we go find the bad guys, whack them out, and they would just kind of skirt and go somewhere else. Well, now we're able to whack and actually hold that terrain. So, you know, we're finally digging out, flushing out all those moles. You had that, and then you had the Sons of Iraq, I think they're called, yeah. It was basically the Sunni awakening, these Sunni groups that previously had allied to Al-Qaeda and had been fighting us and realized that we were actually the lesser of two evils in that country and the most reliable, you know, allies, for lack of a word, or any kind of fighting force that we use, like indigenous or local fighting force. Definitely wasn't the Iraqi police, wasn't the Iraqi army, even though I was actually impressed by some of the folks in those units. And that really depended on where you're at, if you had a good unit or a bad one. But these Shia militias, I mean, the most reliable dudes out there. Absolutely. And the same guys that have been shooting at us, because they knew, again, that that this Al-Qaeda problem, you know, had to go and that we'd eventually, in theory, eventually leave. Yeah, so those two things were
really sad. Okay, we dropped you there, Ryan, but we got you back now.
Okay, so sorry about that.
Nothing to worry about. You're talking about working with the different Iraqi forces and then the Sunni and the Shia. Can you clarify, because you said Sunni and Shia?
Oh yeah. So I'm sorry. So yeah, you know, there's the two. I want to over sound like I'm oversimplifying this, but you know, we know there's two main groups within Islam, Sunni and Shia, and for lack of better word, each had their associated bad guys. In Iraq, right. Generally the bad guys, Sunni guys, were Al-Qaeda affiliates, and the bad Shia guys were Jaish al-Mahdi affiliates. That's the Mahdi army, and they're kind of backed by Iran, and the Sunni militias are backed by, you know, maybe Saudi Arabia, I don't know. But we were in a high-profile battle. It was actually pretty cool. They reconsolidated the unit in southern Baghdad, and we were tasked with basically taking out the last bastion of Al-Qaeda in Baghdad. It was in this neighborhood, Dora East Rashid, depending on who you talk to. Again, southern Baghdad. It actually was a Sunni neighborhood. So it was, I mean, for Baghdad, like kind of semi-suburban there is very different than, you know, semi-suburban here. But, you know, the houses were bigger and nicer and everything. And it was just this neighborhood that, you know, we had left a vacuum in, and Al-Qaeda just moved in there. And what would happen? They would move in. These were nice big houses. 90% of the population left, the civilian population. And the 10% that was left was almost exclusively women and children who just hunkered down because they had nowhere else to go. So they would take these houses, though, now that they're abandoned, and I mean, literally just mix chemicals on these concrete floor and let it dry. And that's how they were making these massive amounts of HME. And they were, I mean, every major intersection, they would just bury, I mean, sometimes water buffalo sized, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pounds of HME in the middle of the intersection. And same thing with houses, homemade explosives, HME. They had a lot of booby trap houses. So we essentially started on one end of this large neighborhood. And over the course of 3 weeks, you know, kept a kind of continuous presence, cordoning off the neighborhood, kind of controlling who went in and out. And just did a clearing operation over the course of 3 weeks and started in the eastern side of it and worked our way to the west. And what was crazy is by the end, and this is when I got hurt, was towards the end. We can talk about that in a second. But, you know, where we had started 3 weeks earlier, the people started coming back. I mean, the information flowed to these folks that were just hunkering down in the countryside or at relatives. I mean, people were back, markets were open, and we had those Sons of Iraq, again, those Sunni militias that we've been previously fighting against that were the most reliable and best fighters that we allied ourselves with, were working with us to keep the peace. And, you know, yeah, there's one more thing that I think did a tremendous job in the success of that period during the surge, in addition to just having a lot of bodies out there and the Sunni militias. And that was the SERP funds. You would go out there as a platoon leader, like $1,000 of U.S. cash in your pocket, you know, with the goal to try to give as much of it away as possible. And we would just give money to people. Oh, you have a broken window? Very easy, kind of seamless paperwork. And I think the U.S. military, granted, some of this money probably got diverted and stolen and, you know, unfortunately. But I think compared to any other organization out there, you know, the U.S. military is one of the few in the world that you can actually just give, you know, junior leaders there $1,000 or more to go spend with very little accountability at the end of the day around it, and actually be confident and know that it was spent wisely and justly and all those things. So those SERP funds, yes, command, I can't remember the acronyms off the top of my head, but hey, your door got blown off. We had nothing to do with it. You know, here, we'll give you $50 anyway, $50 US cash. Oh, your car got blown up. It'd been sitting out there for a couple of months. It was, you know, the car could have been blown up way before we were involved. Here, here's $150, you know. And those, you know, $1,000 in SERP funds were more effective, I think, in quote unquote winning the war than, you know, $100,000 Hellfire missile was. So we moved through, and, it was that when I got hurt, we had, I think a couple of days earlier, had actually finished this clearing operation, and we're just assessing now, or, you know, the last area we cleared, are people moving back in, what are their needs? Whose houses, because there's a shitload of houses there that were still rigged to blow up. Whose houses do we have to send EOD in for and everything?
Tell us about the day you got hurt. Tell us about that. Mm-hmm. What were you doing? Where did it happen? What happened to you?
So, yeah, again, it was October 18th. We're out on patrol, and we actually came out. We were based out of the airport, and I wish I could, like, put a map of Baghdad in people's heads. So we're based at the airport, which was, I don't know, about a 15-20 minute drive to the actual area we were operating in. And there was a closer base, which was maybe about a 10-minute drive, which was about half that distance, which we would kind of often stage from. So we'd either go to the smaller base first and supply or take on some kind of mission or something there, or we'd go out into the sector from the airport and, you know, conduct our missions and then stop by that smaller base on the way back. And sometimes people would just stay out there for the night if you were supposed to be back in sector pretty early the next day. That was Falcon, Bob Falcon. So we were at a biop, and this is Falcon in southern Baghdad. So we were in the westernmost half of this Mahalla. Mahalla is the word for neighborhood there, and meeting with the people who are just, you know, slowly trickling back into the neighborhood. And we had to run to Falcon to pick up something. We were going to be there for about two hours. So this is the afternoon. We run out to Falcon. Everybody's able to get some food. We picked up some stuff, did some resupply, moved some things around. And then we're coming back into the sector. And it's funny because we were on a route. You guys know that all you know, roads in these war zones, especially Iraq and about Afghanistan, but definitely Iraq, everything has a name, like a nickname, or route. Well, it becomes an official name for the military. Route Irish is very well known because that was the road between the airport and the green zone, Jackson Senators. So it's named after location, sports teams, sometimes females, all kinds of things. Well, there was one route that wasn't renamed, and it was Yohamama Road. And I think it was because of, well, I'm pretty sure it was because of the Yo Mama jokes, because even my battalion commander, a pretty serious stoic dude, is dropping Yo Mama jokes on the radio going down Yo Mama.
You can't Yo Mama let the Road. Yo Mama jokes go. Serve that up on a silver platter. Thank you, Iraq.
I remember, yeah, he's like, VC is like, I'm currently, you know, down Yo Mama Road break. Yeah, she's full of trash. She's really dirty. I see some bugs crawling, you know, stuff like that. And you're like, whoa, couldn't help it. But so we're coming back on Yo Mama Road, and this freaking road, we had never had a SIG act on it, period. Even though it was kind of in the middle of this intense neighborhood where this fighting was going on, we hadn't had any IDs. There was a couple of Iraqi during the day police checkpoints on it. And ironically, I found out later, the route clearance teams, some Castle Ironclaw, they had all these names. They're called Ironclaws, and they would, you know, just drive down and take out IDs, would maybe hit that once a week, that route, as part of their schedule. And it was completely random how, you know, of course, how they drove. And that day it got hit twice by the route clearance team. So I don't know if that actually motivated these people or not, or if it's just a coincidence. But we're coming back into the sector on Yohimama. And I'll never forget, I'm looking at it. It's dusk now. It's dark. So it's actually beyond us. So it's dark out. And I'm looking through my MVGs at a neighborhood called the Saha Apartments. And the Saha Apartments were one of the few, it was basically housing projects. In fact, they were kind of remind me of like Iraqi version of like housing projects and brick housing projects you'd see in New York, but made with some kind of like, you know, like tan stone instead. And that's where there was a whole bunch of Shias. It was like the only Shia neighborhood in southern Baghdad. Again, Shias were like, you know, second class kind of citizens, and putting essentially Sadr City was a giant project. So he'd put these folks in projects. And before we got out there, they used to lob mortars back and forth between Saha and this area we had just cleared out, because they used to fight with the Al-Qaeda guys too. So to thank us for clearing out, you know, our mutual enemy, I'm pretty sure this device is an EFP, an explosively formed penetrator, probably the most deadliest type of IED out there. I think this thing had been sitting in there for a while. And I honestly think I've never gotten the full story. I've heard some... I think stories meant to make me feel good, but I'm pretty sure, I think it was just some shitheads saw this thing, was like, oh, we have one of these out there. Here come some Americans. Let's just set it off. And what these EFPs do is they're actually they're kind of a cylinder of metal, anywhere from, you know, 6-8 inches generally in diameter. And they're thick steel on the sides and on one end. And the other end is capped in a soft metal, concave cap, usually copper. And what happens when that explosion occurs, all the energy goes into that piece of copper, since it's being kind of buffered or blanketed by the actual like heavy steel shell around the rest of it, and it actually turns that disc, that concave disc of copper, into a slug of molten copper that travels about 6 miles a second, and it'll generally puncture half of its diameter, its original diameter, in steel. So I mean, those Abrams tanks have been hit by this, and it'll go right through even their reactive armor. That's how powerful these things are, but they're almost a direct fire weapon, in that you can't, you know, you have one, it blows up, that slug misses you, you know, you just got lucky. So what they did was make a raise. They would take 3, 5, 10 sometimes, and just put them at slightly different kind of angles from one another and bury them on the side of the road, and they'd be set off. They would have a switch that would turn the whole system on generally. But then what actually set off the device was passive infrared. So the same thing that turns, you know, your exterior garage door light on when you walk past it at night. So that's what hit us. And I was fortunately in insane shape. I was about 230. I was running sub 12 minute 2 mile. I mean, I only say this because it's the only thing that kept me alive, because we got hit. I'll never forget. It sounded like someone. I was standing up out of the hatch looking to the north of the Saha Apartments. There was another guy who was looking out the south end, kind of standing though in the same area I was, outside of the other hatch. And I'll never forget. It sounded like someone literally yelled the word boom in my head really loud. You know, I was wearing the Bose headset, so they're like noise canceling, but they're really cool because they allow conversations to come through, but they're also will offer protection from loud noises and connect to the radio. So it sounds like someone yells boom. And then, I realized, okay, that wasn't normal. Oh shit. We just got hit by an IED. That was a really small explosion. And we're in front of the Saha Apartments. We just got hit by an EFP. You've got to be fucking kidding me. Like in southern Baghdad. So again, this was not a weapon we were supposed to see down there. And then pretty quickly, I'm thinking to myself, something's up. Sounds like someone yelled the word boom in my ear, which was just, I mean, it's amazing how like your body reacts and just floods it with crazy chemicals as soon as a massive trauma happens. And I suddenly realized, oh shit, I think I got hit by an EFP. And at that moment, I realized all my weight was on my arms, and between my arms, my elbows, and my body or my kit, I was being held up in the hatch. Like I wasn't able to kind of fall through. And at that moment, I couldn't feel my entire lower body. I realized this. And obviously, that's a little disconcerting. So I looked down, you know, thinking, I thought I was going to see like the guy from Black Hawk Down. I was like, well, fuck, that's it for me, I guess. I was like, at least it's not that painful. But I looked down and I see my right leg and it looks fine, you know, in the ACUs. And as soon as I look at it, I can feel, and I plant it on the bench below me. And then I look over at my left leg, and you know, as guys know, like when you get hurt, your ACUs, BDUs, like these uniforms are pretty good actually sometimes, almost too good at hiding the severity of an injury. It just gets kind of soaked with blood, and it just turns dark. I'll tell you, it was so bad. I mean, I'm looking at my tibia kind of like a tree branch sticking out. I'm watching my patella kind of like slide, you know, in this hole that's like now in my knee. And I was like, oh, this is at least my lower body's there. And it was around that time I also passed out in shock or whatever. And I went down and I went to my happy place. And I don't remember any of the details now, but I imagine it was something like, you know, in a Happy Gilmore. Yeah, when Happy Gilmore goes to his happy place, except it was on the beach and it was so warm and comfortable. The one thing I do remember is having a thought in this dream state of, oh, my God, that was a horrible dream. I was just in Iraq and got blown up. And then things just started kind of shaking, and like it's almost like reality started kind of peeling away. And next thing I know, I'm lying at the bottom of the Striker in a pool of blood. The guy behind me, Staff Sergeant Darren Smith, the squad leader, I'm on his leg. I have injuries to my left side. He has injuries to his right, kind of mirrors each other. Fortunately for me, I had so much nerve damage that, I was very uncomfortable, but I actually wasn't in pain per se. And this guy, Darren, was in massive pain. So I'm on his leg. I'm feeling guilty. When we got hit, every single person in the back of the vehicle, got tagged with shrapnel. And one guy died. Wayne Geiger is a California native, was killed instantly. Again, just one of the pieces. This thing, what it would do is the slug would punch through, and as it lost its kinetic energy, it would break up like a shotgun blast. And that's why it was so particularly effective. Once it penetrated, shotgun blasted out. So the guy that died, Wayne, just took, you know, unfortunately took a piece in the face and you know, killed him instantly. And it was weird because you couldn't see that from the other side of him. You just thought he was kind of slumped over. So everybody gets hit. The only person that wasn't hit was the driver. He guns it, gets about 400 meters down the road, and the truck just stops, or the Striker just stops, because the fuel lines got hit. So it turns out the radios got hit, the fuel lines got cut, the ramp that opens up in the hydro or the pneumatic ramp was broken. So it's funny. There's a funny story because we ended up in a place that during the day is an Iraqi checkpoint, and I'll get into what happened after that, after the next day in a second. But yeah, we get out there, and because we just had such a huge presence in the neighborhood, you know, within a minute or two, you know, the company commander's there. The situation now is kind of out of our hands, and now it's just time for me to just focus on staying alive, trying to focus on. I'm trying to crack jokes and I mean, for me, it was just really distracting me about my situation. I was pretty confident at this point. And I only thought my leg, it was my leg. We got a tourniquet on it. And then there was like a hole that above the tourniquet that started like shooting out blood. And we just stuffed it and everything was looking okay. I was going to get to the hospital. Every single person we got to the hospital that was alive when they got there lived. And there was a couple of guys, I think had been dead actually. And they brought them back. So I figure I just got to be alive when I get to the hospital. So I'm trying to crack jokes, and I make some jokes about Rip-Its, which is this cheap energy drink we had out there. And it got back. It got back to the Rip-It people that came there. They visited me in the hospital like weeks later, bought me all kinds of Rip-Its and Rip-It gear and kind of exploited me. And I don't really care, but totally exploited me. Cause then I'm getting calls, you know, a month or two after that from Iraq and emails about how I'm on this poster with a freaking Rip-It hat on and a Rip-It shirt draped over me because I couldn't wear it, a Rip-It gloves, Rip-It foozy, Rip-It, everything in Walter Reed. But yeah, we got me to the hospital. I mean, the best place in the world in 2007, and probably a couple of years before and after that, to get hurt, to have a severe traumatic injury, was actually Baghdad, Iraq. The staff there is incredible. I mean, I had kids x-ray techs, and they're doing this 7-8 times a day, just jumping over me, taking x-rays, not shielding themselves, anything, exposing themselves, you know, left and right, because, you know, they were going to fight just as hard as we were fighting to stay alive, to keep us alive. It was incredible. I was able actually even to call home. I didn't get through with my mother, but I was able to get through with my aunt, who was then able to get through to her. Cause I, again, real quick tangent, just because it's a funny story. My XO our unit XO took a week earlier, took a ricochet in the nose. So this guy legitimately got shot in the face. I mean, you can technically say this guy got shot in the face, and it split his nose, open one of the nostrils, and it was in the middle of a battle or something. So he's just all day. He's not getting it checked out. He's just stuffing his face with like MRE napkins and gauze and any shit he can grab. And he's like this. So at the end of the day, the battalion commander tells him, like, get your ass to the cache and just get that stitched up. And he did not want to go, even though having a Purple Heart actually makes a big difference in life. It turns out, I'm finding out after, with BA and stuff like that. So it's something you don't want. And it's certainly something that, you know, some people probably don't, maybe there's some cases of folks not deserving it. But TJ did not, the guy's name, he didn't want to get a Purple Heart because he didn't feel he earned it compared to some other people. I mean, the guy still got shot in the face. So he goes into the cache. He's like, don't take any of my information. Don't do anything. Just stitch this up. They stitch it up. He leaves. What happens? A couple of days before I get hurt, he's calling home, and his wife is freaking out, like, oh my God, you're alive. You're okay. It's like, what are you talking about? They had called, even though he said, do not report this or anything. There's this kind of standard system where, I mean, if you get killed, obviously you have to have people personally visit you. But if you get hurt, you just get a call, and it's very kind of nebulous as to what the situation is. Like, my mother got, and was on the answering machine because she wasn't home, but a call saying, hey, you know, your son has been severely wounded in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom. You know, please contact at this at your earliest convenience. More details to follow. You know, thank you for being a parent of a certain, you know, something like that. And I'm like, my mother hears that, she's going to, you know, it's bad. So my mother's like a crazy, like, very, very intense New York type. So I made sure I was able to call home, and because I did not want that same thing happening to me.
That's really insane story. I mean, as far as you know, everything from getting wounded to you know, having your military career kind of instantly being over to, you know, you're operating with a team and you're the leader of that team, and all of a sudden the burden of command is kind of lifted from you involuntarily.
Mm-hmm.
Was it hard to make that transition from combat leader to patient? Was it hard to, were you able to let it go mentally? Pretty quickly or not?
You know, I think I think superficially, yeah, I was able to kind of be grateful. I mean, grateful the fact that I was alive. I think that carries you in the beginning. And then, you know, they start doing kind of nice things for you. And this is also when, if you're, you know, at least at that time, when the opiates, you know, really kind of take their grip and you kind of start losing, you start kind of losing a sense of, maybe I'll think that through exactly how to phrase that. But yeah, I of course missed, the struggle is missing your unit, missing your friends over there, not being part of the fight. I'll remember, I 100% believe when I was lying there in Baghdad, I'll never forget, actually. It sounds kind of cliche, but it was one of the most important moments of my, you know, impactful moments of my life, is when I went into surgery. I still didn't know if I was going to live or not, you know, going into surgery, because now we've discovered that, oh my God, all this shrapnel that hit me in the butt is in my stomach, and my liver got hit, my stomach got hit, my bladder got hit, my large, small bowel. I had to get my gallbladder removed a couple of years ago, and that doesn't make any sense unless there was some damage to that too. So that was when I was like, oh shit, you know, that I might not actually survive here. I remember telling the anesthesiologist, like, please do your best to make sure I wake up from this. And like he said, what I guess you have to say is, all right, sure, we got you. But when I came to, I thought it was the next morning. It turns out it was the next night. They just kind of kicked me out for a while. I literally woke up to my battalion commander standing over me with some other staff members, a couple of my friends, you know, awarded me the Purple Heart, said some pretty impactful things. And I remember telling, and he said, don't worry about coming back. We got the fight now. It's fine. You've got your own fight. Yada, yada, yada. You're still part of the team. You know, all the things you kind of have to say. And I'm like, sir, don't worry. Sir, listen, as soon as I can, I might be out of the fight, but I'm going to be back in that talk. I'm going to be part of the effort, yada, 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 as soon as they let me. And, you know, in retrospect now, he's like, yeah, okay, good, good. But just don't rush it, and don't get too upset, you know, if things take a little bit more time, and don't get upset if you actually aren't able to get back. But if you are, of course, you know, we're going to be here to welcome you. There, I mean, there was no way. I was really in pretty bad shape. So honestly, I think that was part of the reason that actually took a lot of, I think I wound up taking a lot of pressure off me, to be quite honest. So I'm super grateful, for many reasons, but that was one of them for my battalion commander. It gave me permission to kind of relax and be, you know, and focus on myself. Then you're just, like I said, I'm just happy that I'm alive. You start taking the medicine, then you're just on opiates all the time. So that I hate to say it, unfortunately, you know, it's bad, and it's kind of what ultimately led me to where I'm at, you know, my industry now. But that makes it a lot easier to deal with too. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised. You know, a lot of the veterans who have opiate addiction issues, even if they were wounded, you know, sometimes it's not even the physical wounds that are doing it. It's just that sense loss of tribal identity. That you know, opiates, frankly, they keep you from caring about it. So I think that was a factor. It made it easier on the surface superficially, but the hardest thing you deal with, any person in the military coming back, is transitioning into a society that is so much now, and even when we recognize and keep saying, hey, there's this huge civilian military divide, and we try to address it, at the end of the day, it just keeps widening. For a whole bunch of reasons. So you come back to a very, very foreign environment that's frankly not oftentimes aligned. And I'm not talking like specific, you know, like values here. I'm talking like very generally, you know, selflessness. I mean, selflessness is exceptionally rare in the civilian world. And even when people do selfless acts, I mean, if you really look at second or third order, you know, causes or effects of it, you know, you realize oftentimes it's tied back to them. You're going to get some kind of value out of it somehow beyond pure altruism. So it's,
you know, though, I think that when you come back from something like that, and one of the big duties that we all have as veterans is in my mind, bringing those values back to the civilian. Mm-hmm. In many ways, looking at what you've done since that point, you were able to do that. You were able to bring kind of a sense of selflessness into what you're doing now, mm-hmm. which we haven't gotten into.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm taking
but which we will in a second. But when did you realize that you had that opportunity to do that? When did you realize that, you know, I've been wounded, my military career might be over, but I still have a chance. I still have a chance to get out there and to do something that can make this society better.
Well, actually, you know, a good point. And one thing when you're talking about how did I feel coming back, how did I make that transition? Well, one of the things I, you know, tried to do was to get involved. And, you know, Wounded Warrior Project, which obviously has, you know, had a troubled history recently. I'll tell you this, that, you know, in 07, 06, 07, 08, that time frame, I mean, they were still doing it. They're still doing incredible things, but they were doing some really, I mean, they were it at the time. They were doing great things, and they really helped me tremendously, not just by, you know, doing nice things and providing some opportunities for me, but actually allowing me the opportunity to then go out there and, you know, advocate for them and advocate for other wounded veterans, you know, through the Wounded Warrior Project and some other activities. So I did a lot of, you know, I worked with them pretty closely, and did some great, you know, help fundraising for them, and also helped them kind of craft and tailor some programs. And I also started doing a lot of just peer mentorship. I went through one of their peer mentorship programs, and I would say, I'll be honest, the 3 years, so I got hurt October 2007. I was in the hospital for 100 days. I went actually to West Point to recover because it was close to home, and they had an administrative unit there that would cover me. And it was, you know, when I got out of the hospital and I was at West Point, I was all by myself. That was when the struggle for me began, because I had no kind of peer group around me. So believe it or not, those 3 years, I was doing a lot of stuff with the Wounded Warrior Project, but between the medications, between this my unit, and frankly, this schedule of surgeries, I was having a surgery every 3 months and they kept failing. And what was really taking its toll on me was, you know, keeping this, I felt I had to always show the most positive face externally, you know, especially since I was doing all this advocacy and everything. And that actually took its toll on me, you know, constantly being disappointed and having to pretend like it just didn't disappoint me. So those 3 years, I probably, other than doing some fundraising for Wounded Warrior Project, were kind of a lost 3 years. And that was the 3 years before I had my amputation. So I actually had my leg for 3 years before I had amputated below the knee. After the amputation is when I was really able to start kind of doing these things, I think, full force. And peer mentorship was one of them down at Fort Sam Houston, being able to both informally and formally. I mean, I would just hang out. There's nothing else to do. Hang out at the recovery center, work out all day, and just see the other guys. A new guy comes in. What was particularly in 2010 was happening. If you came back from Afghanistan and you weren't a triple amputee, you were lucky. I mean, that's how bad things got. That's how good we got at keeping people alive, and how the fight had kind of changed over there. That people were having you step on a dismounted IED. That leg's gone usually above the knee. The other leg's gone above or below the knee. And whatever arm you were leading with is also gone. And usually the fourth limb is damaged. So that was, that was actually challenging, but also rewarding, you know, considering me now and help put my injury in perspective. I mean, I'm a single below the knee amputee. I mean, on my left leg too, this is like the paper cut of, I don't want to minimize it at all, but this is like the paper cut of these traumatic injuries. So being able to mentor is a way, it's because you're not just helping them. You don't realize you're doing a lot of help for yourself, especially when you come from an environment of selflessness and of camaraderie and of a tribal nature. So yeah, just to kind of sum it up, I mean, when I eventually, especially when I started finally having a lot of success medically and physically, was when I was really able then to, especially based on those 3 years of kind of feeling in purgatory and seeing a lot of guys, you know, in that position, was able to talk to them and I think affect some positive change in some folks' lives.
How long until you were actually out of the Army, and then what was that transition like, and what did you transition to?
So I got hurt in 07. I spent 3 years with the leg, trying to do limb salvage, had the amputation in 2010. And then one thing I was able to do during that kind of 3 year limbo period was I got into grad school. So I got into Harvard, a dual program there for both the business school. So I got an MBA and a Master of Public Policy at the Kennedy School, all paid for by the government. So again, no, can't complain too much there. So I had that, you know, I had that to look forward to. So I had my amputation again, fall of 2010. Over the next year, had an incredible recovery experience down in Fort Sam Houston, San Antonio. Again, the best place in the world to, just like Baghdad was the best place to get hurt, that was the best place in the world, it might still be, for traumatic injury recovery, you know, longer term recovery. Because I got the amputation in September. I got my first leg right around Thanksgiving, and I did a tough mutter in January. I mean, that's how quickly they are progressing us and how strong the program was down there. So I spent the next year, in retrospect, I think, I've done a lot of thinking over the past few years. So I kind of, you know, see things a little bit differently. I think what I really needed to do is after, you know, 3 or 4 years of just being so limited in life, I was just out there enjoying life. I wasn't preparing at all to like start grad school or even thinking about it. I was just working out every day. I was traveling a lot. I was doing a lot of veteran advocacy. I was doing a lot of physical. I was doing like triage, there were people recovering it. So I was going doing triathlons all over the place, doing these multi-day, you know, a lot of physical things. And what was good about that too is, you know, that was advocacy in itself. When you see a guy, with one leg who, again, now I'm, you know, back to like a very physically fit, you know, specimen now, or at least at that time, not now anymore. But, it actually just visually, that kind of image is inspiring to a lot of people, both people going through struggles, you know, my fellow warriors and people who are supporting us. So that was great and all, but, you know, I wasn't really, I started school. I wound up starting grad school in that fall, and there was a little bit of overlap while I was still in the Army, and they pretty much effectively let me kind of do my own thing while I was just waiting on the disability process and their retirement process to finish out. So I started school at the Kennedy School in 2011, in the fall. And, you know, in retrospect, I struggled. I really struggled in grad school. I had a lot of cognitive challenges. Realized I wasn't as interested in learning, I think, as I don't know, just like socially. I think I almost tried to force myself to reintegrate society by just partying all the time. And in grad school, at Harvard, believe it or not, I mean, the business school is, I don't want to say it's a big party. You're with the smartest people in the world there. And in the classroom, I mean, it's incredible. But there also is a very, very large, intense social component to it.
Now, are you still medicated heavily at this point?
No. Okay. Yeah. So I should fill you in. So one of the reasons I wanted to get the amputation was I was taking massive doses of painkillers every day, and I didn't think there was any way to get off the painkillers until I had the amputation. And when I went down to Fort Sam Houston, I went down there in April of 2010 to get an amputation. I figured, hey, can we get me on the schedule next week? I met up with the team, all these doctors, and I said, hey, I'm here to get my leg cut off. Let's get this on the schedule. I'm ready. I'm good. And they said, you know, we've got this with one last thing. It's amazing orthotic brace we want you to try. I told them I wasn't interested. I already tried one last thing like two or three times. I'm done. They said, you really should try this out. We're having amazing success. We have some CAG dude running around, some Delta Force guy, literally, I mean, running around, you know, Afghanistan in one of these things. This is the real deal. I said, hey, that's great and all. I'm ready to get the amputation. When can we go? And they told me, we're sorry to tell you, nobody's going to do the amputation. If you try this and it fails, then we'll do the amputation. And okay, so I think there was some altruistic motive there. I mean, in all honesty, they just got a ton of money to study limb salvage and to study this thing. So they needed participants. So it was a convenient way to kind of force participation in that. And for a while I did kind of hold that against folks, but I will say, whereas that brace, you know, didn't and was never going to save my leg for a whole bunch of reasons. In fact, it got worse in a sense while I was wearing it, because as I got stronger, and my leg got strong because I was finally able to run, squat, jump, lift, you know, on this mangled leg because I was effectively wearing a prosthetic, you know, over my leg. And I had this guy, Johnny Owens. I mean, this guy literally wrote the book on limb salvage physical therapy. And we're doing 3 hours of like professional sports level physical therapy every day with this guy. And over time, what that did is, you know, with nerves and with pain, especially. And most of my pain was neuropathic, so nerve-based. Those nerves, once they start feeling pain, and there's no other stimulation because I'm not walking on it, and it's constantly getting, because it was so vascularly messed up, you know, it's constantly swelling, unswelling. This nerve just doesn't know what else to do but to feel pain. And then when you start piling the opiates on top of it, it's really kind of sinister in a way that the way these things work. It's because, you know, I need these now for this pain, and because it also feels good. My body, I'm pretty sure, would amp up the pain and make it feel even worse and required me to take more. It wasn't just I was getting tolerant of it. I think my body actually started feeling pain on purpose because it knew it got, you know, my brain got its dose of dopamine from the drugs. As I was able to start kind of running, jumping, and doing this physical therapy, I started noticing that, oh my goodness, like the pain is going away. And I was shocked at how quickly I was able to get off. I mean, I went from like 80 milligrams of methadone a day, which is huge. They were putting us all on methadone at the time because it was cheap and easy. And then I was taking other stuff too on top of that. And I'll never forget one of the most memorable moments of my life, surprisingly, is when I never thought I'd be able to do this. I had like half a bottle of painkillers, and I went to the pharmacy and threw them in the, you know, the rectification, whatever the hell the box is called. I never thought I'd be able to actually physically give up and throw out pain medication. I just think I either thought I was going to be in too much pain or the, you know, dependence, addiction, whatever you want to call it, would be too powerful. So I went into my surgery, completely off painkillers and also off any, done with withdrawals and everything. I had a short withdrawal period, thankfully, too, because they did a really good job of kind of mitigating that. The problem was, though, you know, I wasn't in immediate pain anymore, but there were still a lot of effects. I mean, I still had a lot of physical challenges from time to time, and I still would have general pain. And I had a lot of issues with restless leg. So again, but I'm off the painkillers. I'm off all medications. I have a very successful, you know, year of just working out and traveling and stuff. I start grad school. I'm cognitively struggling. And I think a lot of it has to do with, again, the medication, years and years of medication. A lot of it has to do with, I just wasn't, you know, in retrospect, ready. I just wanted to get on with my life that even though I think if I would have actually sat there and I was, am I ready to go back to school? I would have outright said no. I went anyway. And I graduated. I did fine. One of the things, unfortunately about these schools is, you know, if you get in, as long as you show you, at least show you want to be there, you know, you'll get through and graduate. But, you know, I loved school. And it's weird. I didn't love school in grad school. And now I'm finally loving learning again. So now I'm like, darn, I think we do just have these periods in life where we're just more open, I guess, for information and learning and things like that excites us. And it kind of goes up and down. Then you have a period where you just want to go execute on that knowledge. So I'm actually, my long-term goal now is to go back to school for something completely different than business, for physics, believe it or not, and kind of get myself out of the game after hopefully, you know, I have to make a few bucks, A, and then B, also have created some, whether it's a business or something that's going to actually give back, both in jobs and then in just positive externalities to society and especially veterans.
That's amazing that you were able to get through, graduate school like that. You know, as far as the opiates go, I've had my problems with opiates in the past, and a lot of people might know I suffer from a disease called ulcerative colitis, mm-hmm. which I also know that you
which
have
I
as
have.
Well.
Yeah.
And one of the only things there were two things that ever gave me relief from the pain. One was opiates, mm-hmm. and the opiates were a problem for me because they started intervening into my life significantly. I like to say that I was prescribed them, but no, I actively searched them out on the streets, mm-hmm. and, you know, eventually was buying pills at like $5 to $6 a pill. And, you know, found myself on my front lawn searching for one that I thought I'd lost and all kinds of crazy things going on. And I've been through the withdrawals, I've been through everything, but there's nothing that really, in my mind, that I've ever taken that actively embeds itself in your DNA, mm-hmm. to the point where you crave them. The other thing that has really helped me has had very little negative side effects, which I was very resistant to trying for a very long time until I educated myself, was cannabis. Mm-hmm. And I recently this year got my California cannabis card, and we haven't gotten into this at all yet, but you are in the cannabis industry. And I want to hear a little bit about how you first came in touch with cannabis. Cause I know a good U.S. Army officer, West Point graduate from, you know, who's been kind of stringing hero yeah. the whole time. You know, it's kind of a regular thing for you to be involved with. And I want to know how you got in contact with it, how you learned about it. How did you change your perceptions about it? And what's it doing for you now?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, no, I appreciate it. I'm glad. And thanks for sharing, you know, that little bit about yourself. I mean, that's one of the first things I know. I actually lied to myself a lot early on about, hey, do I really need to take. And yeah, granted, for me, it was prescribed, but still, I would do things like, you know, and it was really out of boredom, you know, and not having a peer group or anything. I would just sit there and take 3 days worth of drugs in one dose and then try to ride it out, you know, the stuff you do is crazy. But yeah, for cannabis, I'll be honest, I tried it a couple of times in high school. I mean, the first couple of times, you know, I think I quote unquote tried it. nothing happened, which, you know, probably good. I wasn't, you know, inhaling or whatever, you know, whatever we do when we first try and it doesn't happen. And I thought it was like tough. Like, yeah, I could smoke this stuff all day and nothing happens. And then I had, and then something happened. It was like one of the worst experiences of my life. And I realized that, I guess, when I actually got it into my system, I mean, I think I took like one puff that finally got in there in high school, and I spent the next 8 hours afraid for my life. I couldn't feel my entire midsection. It was like 1 second would go by and then 3 seconds of blank. It was super scary. So that, plus I think my at that time kind of my like political views, I went to an extremely, one of the most liberal high schools in America, and instead of rebelling, well, my mother's pretty liberal too, but so I guess I was rebelling against her too, but I was like a super conservative. So, and this was just great, you know, more ammunition for me to say this stuff is clearly bad. I remember on the football team, this is amazing now, years later, I remember guys were going out and like, I was hearing about dudes smoking weed, you know, either the night before, not even the night before game, like the night after game. So it wasn't even like beforehand. And I went and I was saying, this is like, you know, what like wimps do. And like, you know, I used all the typical colorful, like anti-hippie weed language. And
it's your brain on drugs.
Yeah. And meanwhile, the guy's like, what about drinking? I was like, well, drinking's fine, of course. Drinking's fine, but drinking fine, even the night before a game, drinking's acceptable. But yeah, and I was a captain, is pretty pathetic. But yeah, smoking weed, absolutely not. No one on this team, I'll crush you. I'll personally kick your ass. You know, things like that. So got away from it, you know, didn't really think much of it throughout West Point. And I think my views have certainly changed. I'm much more moderate and more progressive now, but in general. But yeah, I get to the military, go off, do all this stuff. Even when I was recovering, didn't really, you know, think about this as a therapy. And I remember seeing things like it cured. And I wasn't, at this point too, I wasn't against it or anything. You know, I kind of shifted out of that. But I just still didn't really even think of it because I'm living in New York and because I was still in the Army, of course. And even when I was up in Boston, I was in the Army for a little bit, and I don't know, just, you know, there was no access, so I didn't realize what it could potentially do for me. And I was, again, I was struggling with a lot of things, not as much physically. I mean, I had, you know, some nights restless leg would keep me up, and, you know, I'd have, actually, in retrospect, I was probably taking, you know, 2 or 3 Advil a day, ibuprofens a day, and I didn't even realize it, how I was eating these things like candy. So I was taking a lot of ibuprofen over those years. And now I think I've taken like 6 in the past like year or two. But yeah, the thing that was getting me most, I think, was mood issues. And you know, certain feelings of, yeah, just in general, just mood bounce back and forth, feeling like a lot of times too, self-esteem was kind of shot, and it was really sometimes from an overactive mind. So there's a whole bunch of things going on up in there. And I wasn't taking any kind of, you know, like, you know, psychoactive or anything like medications or anything like that. And I guess it wasn't really that bad. So I guess I kind of just dealt with it. But when I got out to, and I think at, you know, at a detriment at times, when I finally moved out to California after graduating in 2014, it was about 4 or 5 months. I kept seeing the dispensaries and I kept saying, you know, I should probably get my card and like investigate this, you know, and see if there's anything that can help me out, you know, therapeutically, medically or anything. And finally, after about 6 months, I went, got my card. I remember I told them I was a veteran. There was like, you know, other veterans in there. And we started talking, waiting out their card, and they're telling me, come to this dispensary. We've got the best veterans discount. And it kind of opened my eyes too in California. I mean, it's basically de facto legal here because, I mean, nowadays you can go on to a website, have a video teleconference with a doctor who will give you a recommendation. They'll port you over to delivery service and you can have legal cannabis, you know, in an hour and a half from first moving into the state. So it was kind of a big surprise. But yeah, I went to a dispensary and I was surprised too about, you know, how, even though the guy kind of looked like a typical stoner, like how informative, you know, and how knowledgeable he was about, and it wasn't like, dude, this will get you feeling good, and dude, this will get you like feeling sleepy. It was, you know, what are your, you know, if you don't mind, what are your issues, or in general, can you share them to me? I prefer this. This has this effect. You know, have you thought about edible? I mean, very, and the same thing, actually, the doctor too kind of touches on it as well. I was like, wow, this is actually a lot more professional than I realized. So I started using, and to be quite honest, it was mostly the main reason. Actually, I think the main reason I got it, it'll be nice to be able to, maybe have some therapeutic benefit. But I just frankly, I mean, my main reason to get it was recreational. I just want to try it again and see what it was all about. And I tried it and I realized that, holy crap, like for a lot of what ails veterans, this is incredible. I mean, again, hypervigilance hits, it just centers you really well. And especially as you learn the different strains and how to use it appropriately. The swelling issue, I didn't realize how much inflammation I had in my body.
I think that as far as everything goes, education is really a big deal when it comes to cannabis, because you have to know that if you were going to take a certain dose and if you consume it in an edible, so to speak, you are going to be faced with certain, you know, thoughts like you experienced in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had experiences where I've took a little bit too much,
mm-hmm.
and I was like, I am never doing this again. Cause then, you know, those thoughts come into your mind like, oh my God, I'm going to die someday. And I haven't done anything with my life yet.
Oh, and all spirals. These, yeah. You can get those spirals and it just spirals out of control. Yeah.
But if you take the right dose and if you use it, responsibly, mm-hmm. I think, I've had so many benefits as far as reducing inflammation and actually even feeling cognitively sharper at times on certain doses. And I think that that's the real deal. And that's the benefit of what we have here in California as far as dispensaries and the knowledge base available.
Mm-hmm.
As far as everything goes, in your dealings with you know, trying to advocate for cannabis and for veterans, what types of things do you try to relate to them as far as how they can benefit from it? What types of strains they should be using and what the best route for them is?
Mm-hmm. Well, first, let me give a public service announcement here it's funny when you talk about education, it really is the biggest thing because it's hard. It's an uphill battle because that stigma, we don't realize how deeply ingrained the war on drugs stigma and the anti-pot stigma or cannabis stigma is in our head. I mean, I still wake up sometimes like, what the hell am I doing with my life? Am I in the right business? And it's this irrational fear and I have to temper it down and see like all these great things that some for veterans. I'm going to tell you about one program in particular that's phenomenal. But the first PSA is, believe it or not, if you ever get into that situation where you have this paranoia attack or anxiety attack on cannabis, do you know what the cure is? Or the best, fastest cure?
Cup of coffee, right?
No, believe it or not, it's another form of cannabis. So,
really?
Yeah. So THC, you know, and again, this is the education piece. Cannabis is an incredibly complex plant. What's amazing about it is it's complex and it's all these different, again, it's not just cannabinoids that have direct effects on a certain endocannabinoid system, which is basically a messaging system within your body. But there's terpenes, which are scent molecules. There's flavonoids, which are flavor molecules that actually, when people talk about strains, it's not even so much the proportions of the different cannabinoids. A lot of times it's these terpenoids and flavonoids that interact, you know, with your body and really tailor how your body is using those cannabinoids. It's really crazy. In fact, you can get a different experience from eating, smoking, vaporizing the same strain, and actually you can get it at different vaporization temperatures. You're converting different things at different proportions, so you can get a different experience from that. So it can be a little intimidating. It's pretty complicated, but one of the big efforts in cannabis right now is to kind of simplify a lot of that and say, hey, this isn't too scary. So the substance I was talking about that actually mitigates a high is called CBD, and folks are going to start hearing a lot about CBD.
And I have some on my desk right now.
It's absolutely incredible. And I'll tell you what, I think 10 years from now, and this goes to the education and actually replacing stigma with knowledge piece. I think 10 years from now, you know, tens of millions of Americans are going to be taking CBD and other cannabis derived supplements every day of their life. Because in addition to all the therapeutic benefits, mood stabilization, anti-inflammation, just in general pain control, things like that. CBD and THC too is responsible for this. it has anti-diabetic effects. It actually helps your body better utilize blood sugar, which is why, you know, consequently, even with quote unquote bunchies, you don't really see heavy cannabis users are never fat. And they're also too, because it's generally that lifestyle, you actually are a lot more physically active. Most of the hardcore cannabis consumers I know are in great shape. And then there's the anti-tumor effects too, which I didn't believe until I actually saw the studies in the animal, in vitro and even in vivo models. Now they're showing, and they know the mechanism of action, how, you know, certain cannabinoids basically are able to kill certain types of tumor cells at an early stage. So going back though to the CBD, what it does is it actually it's an antipsychotic. So if you are having, and I've anecdotally seen this, and I finally tried it myself, and I have a pretty high tolerance now just because I'm in the industry and I use it almost every day in different forms. It took a lot, but I finally was able to manufacture that like anxiety feeling and that spiral again. And I took I think every responsible cannabis consumer, even if you just do it rarely, if there's any chance, like a kid or, you know, you can have a friend that would take this and freak out, is to have a vape cartridge and a vape pen with CBD in it, pure CBD or, you know, 20-1, 10-1 high strength CBD, because if you are freaking out, you'll take two puffs off that thing. It's like a rescue inhaler for an asthmatic. It just knocks it. It just knocks that stupor right out of you. And you still, it kind of like dulls the high, you know, high a little bit, but all the medical therapeutic effects are still going to be there. And you're not going to be freaking out anymore. So CBD, highly recommend if anybody, a lot of people, honestly, that CBD vape is really all you need for most of your medical, most of your medical issues anyway.
Yeah. And you hit it. Wow. Anti-inflammatory properties, but what it also, adds is neuroprotective.
Yeah. Yeah.
Properties, you know, again, so that's why people are being able to take it right now with tympanic brain injury or even post-traumatic stress and see a tremendous benefit from those anti-inflammatory and neuroprotective properties. But I'm kind of like you, Ryan. I was jumping in head first. I wanted to understand, you know, the research. What was the new science? You know, why did the, you know, reefer madness propaganda, what was that deal with that in the 30s, and you know, what is the real risks to health? But the biggest eye opener to me was learning about the endogenous cannabinoid system, and they have cell receptors in your body, and your body actually has more cell receptor sites for cannabinoids than any other compound in your body. So they have what they call CB1, which is cell receptors in your brain, and then CB2, cell receptors for cannabinoids in the body. And the reason that you cannot overdose on cannabis is there is essentially no cell receptors having to do with the respiratory system. Mm-hmm. And so that's where people overdose on opioids, is they take too many and it floods the system. It gets into those cell receptors in the respiratory system and shuts it off. Well, that mechanism is not even something that can get into with cannabis. And so that's another incredible, knowledge key point there, that I was just like, this is amazing. You're telling me that we have all these cell receptors in our body. It's the most prevalent in the human body. It's in the brain and the body and the system, or the signal that could make it potentially lethal, mm-hmm. is not active. Man, that sounds like it's almost too good to be true.
It's insane. It really is insane. Water will kill you faster than cannabis. I mean, there's effectively no way it will directly kill you. You're right. The brainstem, again, no CB1 receptors in there. It's opiate receptors, or tons of opiate receptors in the brainstem, which is why I think it's something like 5-1, the lethal dose over the medium effective dose. So many substances, so many everyday nutmeg will kill you way, 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 way faster than cannabis. Now, cannabis, again, if you know, used, I don't want to say improperly, but I guess if used unknowingly, can make you feel like you're dying and want to die. There is absolutely no way that it can kill you.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that we are so okay with prescribing pills and chemicals, mm-hmm. and all of these things that are super addictive, that have a side effect
or that can heal you in every which way. You know, even Advil, we think of Advil and NSAIDs as being kind of relatively harmless, but they can wreak havoc on your digestive mm-hmm. system. And if you have ulcerative colitis or something like that, they can kill you. And they can give you all sorts of different problems that will last for
very
years.
Toxic on the liver.
But with plants, you know, in cannabis, I can't imagine why there's so much resistance to making it widely available and to making it fully legal.
It's a misinformation campaign that goes back to the 30s and then just has gone forth through culture and society unchecked. Or at least that's how I think I see it. How do you see it, Ryan?
I mean, I just see it as in the whole war on drugs is just a another mechanism of control. I mean, again, we can go off on a really long tangent here about social justice stuff. But, you know, it was a convenient way to, you know, find another reason, you know, in my opinion, to, and if you look throughout history, to overwhelmingly, well, there is the hippie movement, too, that it was able to shut down a potential communist movement. But then especially like black and brown, you know, communities, it's just an easy way of you know, kind of implementing a new system of control over them, helping to bolster the prison industrial complex. I mean, there's stuff with these capitation costs that, I mean, with your private prison, I mean, you get paid every body you put in there.
All you got to do is follow the numbers, look at the evidence and assess, is this where we would want to be as a culture and society? No one would say yes. You know what I mean? It's an utter and complete failure.
Yeah. Yeah. And now I think, you know, I see it on Twitter. I mean, I see people from all of the spectrum, everything from the hippies to I see Pepe the Frogs, you know, cause I have a pretty, you know, for cannabis, it's actually pretty active on Twitter in general. And they're all, I mean, no matter who they are all like, come on, guys, like this is bullshit now. This is
Yeah, it's gone beyond politics, man. It's gone way beyond politics. And you know, we think of the Democratic Party as being super progressive toward cannabis. But, you know, Hillary Clinton was basically telling stockbrokers or not stockbrokers, but people from the financial industry behind closed doors that she was going to do everything she could to keep it illegal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so what I think is going on now is that we've seen the bullshit behind mm-hmm. it. We've seen the fact that there is this kind of mechanism of control and interest. Mm-hmm. And we've got people from all political spectrums who are utilizing cannabis and who are benefiting from it and who are starting to question, well, why the hell do I even need to have this prescribed? Why the hell is it illegal?
Yeah.
You know, that's crazy.
Well, now I honestly think everybody knows the ship has sailed. This is going to be legal. And now I honestly think it's just, again, big money interest, big pharma realize this is, I don't want to sound like all anti this and that. But, you know, I really think, I mean, just put yourself in the shoes of a pharmaceutical company. I mean, it's not like they're, you know, you're even being sinister or anything. Just put yourself in their shoes. All of a sudden, there's a substance out there that can, you know, crush my bottom line. I've got stakeholders and shareholders that I'm responsible to. You know, I've got all these pressures. Of course, I'm going to have to defend. I mean, most the average person, and this is, you know, like you see this a lot, even in coal country and things like that. The average person's going to, you know, not sit there and say, hey, I don't want to have to change my whole, you know, model or sacrifice. And the pharmaceutical, I mean, it could collapse. Some companies can get crushed. I mean, it's nature of any kind of organism to include a business to fight for its survival. So that's why I think what you're seeing now is pharma and maybe even some other, you know, like even the beer companies, all these big, big businesses that, again, have ties with folks in power are going to do what they would naturally do, which is, you know, self-preservation. And they're just all trying to figure out right now how they're going to be able to capitalize and take advantage of the market. But I think just structurally and culturally, the cannabis, I think, you know, just by the nature of business and people and stuff, you know, there will be a big cannabis one day. I think that there's enough, you know, culture and impetus within cannabis to at least maintain a very, very, very strong, almost like a craft beer or like a wine Appalachian type kind of model where you have your cheap, you know, but mass produced, whatever type weed. And then you have your kind of higher quality, stuff out there. But yeah, I don't think they're going to have that any of these outside companies are going to come in and be an external player that comes and makes big cannabis. Corporate sabotage is pretty easy in cannabis. All you need is a male plant, and you shake a male plant around a farm, because all cannabis plants are female, and basically the way that you get really good cannabis is by sexually frustrating that female by not allowing it. You know, all it wants to do is make seeds, and needs pollen to make seeds. So when you prevent it from getting pollen, it just tries to like capture pollen more, so it's making more resin, and all its energy is going towards, you know, improving its chances of catching a seed, and all that is creating more and more of the good stuff that we want. So it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out from an intellectual curiosity standpoint. I mean, it's a pretty fun business to be in because of how many different kind of levers there are to kind of pull and push. Obviously, a double-edged sword, that could also be pretty stressful. But
tell us a little bit about what you do in the industry. What exactly is your role, and how do you go about your business?
So I was coming off, I was working in healthcare, and labor, you know, and staffing was one of my biggest issues. So that, you know, that was kind of in the back of my head. And I was at this job. I wasn't particularly happy with it. On a whim, speaking of education, you know, and I've been using kind of a little bit here and there cannabis, and started educating myself. And I was, married to someone from Humboldt County, who's, that's like where most of the weed's growing up in Northern California there. So her family, you know, kind of grew up, everybody up there has some connection to the industry. So I learned more about the industry through her. And I went to Oaksterdam University on a whim, which sounds kind of kitschy, but, it's, you know, Amsterdam and Oakland combined. But it really is one of the most important institutions in cannabis because of the education they're doing. They're educating not just, you know, potential entrepreneurs, but they're educating the grandmas who hear about this and say, maybe this is something I want to try. They're educating policymakers from around, you know, both state and federal level, lawmakers at both the state and federal level. And again, sending this information and debunking a lot of the myths and misinformation out there. And I did that for 4 days, and realized, wow, there's so much opportunity in this industry, and it's something I believe in. Maybe this is where I should look. And an incubator, I found this incubator Gateway that had their application due in a couple of days. And I realized, well, shit, it'll be a lot easier to, transition to a new job if I'm getting paid. So I applied. I went, I spent a whole day just brainstorming what is the biggest pain point in this industry that can be addressed. And I realized it's a labor issue. You know, it's a staffing issue. And the biggest cost in the production of cannabis is called trimming. And it's finishing the product from when it's grown to before it's wholesaled, whether that's as flowers to dispensaries or, you know, as intermediates to manufacturers who make edibles or extracts or something like that. Again, it's biggest cost. It's highly manual. It's been very difficult to automate, and it's very hard to find these laborers because of the even in legal regulated marketplaces. You know, people aren't just there's no you know, ladders or Indeed. I mean, there are some staffing agencies for higher end cannabis jobs as the industry develops, but for this kind of job, like this gig type contingent labor job, which you only need these folks for like a week at a time, there is no good system in place. So my company Field is approaching this, you know, approaching the staffing problem, not so much from a top-down staffing agency approach, but from a bottoms-up social networking approach. So growers, we get growers to put, you know, their trimmers on there that they've been using already. So the first thing we do is we automate, you know, their calling lists, which is something that saves them a lot of time and offers immediate value. And then the second thing we're doing is then expanding, you know, the network of trimmers they have access to, which ultimately allows what we're trying to get to is almost an on-demand system where I'm a grower. I have some plants coming up that need to be trimmed next week. Instead of going 6 weeks out, then calling a week again to confirm, and then the day of still nobody showing up, I mean, I can ultimately the day of find, you know, confidently hire 5 or 6 people for the next 3 days if I needed to.
That's pretty cool. I heard it said once about the gold rush that the best business person to be during the gold rush was a pick and shovel salesman.
Yeah. So that's definitely the thought behind this and a lot of the ancillary products that are out there. And what's really cool is, you know, it's still really early on. And because the it's a unique enough, the cannabis industry, that you can't just use off the shelf products, that you see a lot of innovation actually happening within this, within the industry. I know one of the things, first things we plan on doing with this beyond cannabis is applying it to agriculture in general. You know, there's a lot of agricultural jobs too that are very similar. And you know, there's a lot of often done by migrant labor, type jobs where, you know, having a reducing the friction of finding these folks, you know, and getting them on the site is very valuable.
A couple of things, man. So say there's somebody out there right now, you know, veterans, whether they're college students, somebody who wants to get into the cannabis industry at this point. Like you said, it's still pretty early on. What types of steps should they be taking?
So it really, because of the nature of the market, you know, it really, a lot of it depends on where they live and what, you know, the legal status in their state is. I mean, if you live in a state like Texas, which is going to be one of the last to, you know, have grant access. Well, I mean, you never know. Utah is actually coming around, surprisingly. But, you know, let's say Texas, let's say they're going to be a holdout. You know, that's going to limit you from anything that touches the plant. But you can, of course, I know there's a lot of companies in Austin that are doing, again, ancillary tech projects. Or you know, tech plays, whether it's for managing inventory or tracking, seed to sale tracking, which is, you know, compliance, which is very big within our industry. So it's, you know, identifying A, what you're legally able to do where you live, or B, you know, where you're open to moving to, Denver, Boulder, and the Bay Area, and Santa Cruz, and LA actually too. LA is just kind of so big and it's spread out. I think the industry down there, whereas it's a little bit more, it's easier to like find folks up here because it's a little bit more concentrated. You know, these are the places to go if you're interested in cannabis. But actually, correction, you know, new states coming online. So Pennsylvania, for instance, I'm part of an organization that's seeking licensure out there. We just, you know, we kind of missed on our first opportunity. But there'll be more. So if you're in a state, which is, you know, if and you're interested in getting the industry and you want to touch the plant, and honestly, I think growing, like any kind of farming, you know, the historically the profession that called for the, you know, combat weary soldier, has always been farming, going out and actually creating life from the land after you've taken it, super peaceful. And when you're farming cannabis, I mean, then you get to actually, you know, smoke this great medicine at the end of the day. I mean, it really can't be more perfect. And hemp, I also want to plug hemp right now. Hemp is another industry that has suffered indirectly, essentially, because of the drug war, because it's, you know, essentially the cannabis plant, but without, you know, most of the cannabinoids. It, too, we haven't been able to build an industry, and that's an incredible, incredible substance. And that's going to open up tons and tons of new jobs from construction to health foods to all different applications that you get from hemp.
That's a source of CBD as well, is it?
Yes,
not?
Yeah. So hemp is it is the cannabis sativa plant. So it's the same plant. It's just almost like a breed. It puts most of its energy into building its fibers, and very little of its energy is into actually perpetuating like the female cannabis plants typically do. So they build really, really strong stalks. The one cannabinoid they primarily put out is CBD. There's mixed things right now as to whether CBD from hemp is as good as CBD from, you know, cannabis. I think at the end of the day, you know, cannabis, you have more of a whole plant entourage effect, but you can take the CBD and you still get a lot of value, and it's still a great substance you're getting from hemp. So yeah, I would say if follow your state, first of all, you can reach out to me. I will talk to any veteran, and I have a pretty good network of veterans in cannabis that I can direct you towards too. So ryan@fieldapp.co, please feel free. And I don't know if there's a way to, you know, we can put that also in
text. Yeah, just text that over to me. I'll make sure it goes into the show notes.
So yeah, and just I mean, that's probably the easiest thing to do is just reach out to me, because I love to talk. I'll talk to any veteran and help them one-on-one. I think it's more of a one-on-one thing to kind of figure out what makes most sense. But yeah, if you're living in a place where you can't touch the plant, ancillary products, if you're living in a state, like Some states are still looking for license still approving licenses. That's kind of a lot of work, but if you can, get with some people who are in the know and you're a veteran, that gives you an advantage most places to get a license. And then, of course, like Pennsylvania, they're going to need, folks to work the dispensaries, folks to work the farms. And one of the big things we're going to do is prioritize hiring veterans. And I have to make one more plug. I know I've been doing this forever for for why cannabis is so effective or some of the programs I've seen that have worked with veterans. One in particular is my buddy who's also named Ryan Miller. He's the other main veteran in cannabis in the Bay Area.
I read about him.
And honestly, he's a guy like it puts a lot of pressure on me because he is such an incredible, like good, positive person. In the past, if I screwed up, it's only my own name I'm tarnishing. Well, now I gotta worry about this guy. So it's good and bad because it's gonna keep me in line. But he's a great guy. We're great friends. And he has this program, Operation EVAC, educating veterans about cannabis, nonprofit that he actually barely, he still lives. This guy loves and supports veterans so much. I mean, he's a veteran too, that, he's still living at home. He's fine with it because he gets so much from this organization. I'm going to give you an example of why it's so special. I want to see this model duplicate. This is something else veterans can do if you have access to cannabis, to start a program like this. Is, he has a bunch of dispensaries that lend him some space, and dispensaries and producers will donate medicine as well. And he does this almost every day of the week now at different dispensaries, an hour-long group therapy session, and then 20 minutes of guided meditation. And at the end, you get, a little bag of free medicine, which is actually a pretty decent bag for a pretty decent amount, for free. And what's so powerful about this is the story of this one guy who I met there pretty early on. And I got to talking to him, and he's like, dude, I was in the street, and I'd wake up, I would scrounge some money together, and I'd put a needle in my arm, and either I got really high or I died, and both of those were equally acceptable outcomes. Because, I'm a veteran, but I'm so far gone. The VA, like I said, the VA can be a challenge. The VA wasn't helping him, so he gave up on the VA. And then on top of that, he didn't even want to see other veterans because he was so ashamed of his situation. And he was basically waiting to, for that one shot to kill him. And he came in. I asked him, well, is it the free medicine that brought you in? He's like, that was a help. But he's like, I wouldn't have come in if it was just free medicine. Or I would have gone, there's some other organizations that will give out free medicine. You can kind of grab it and then sneak off. He said, I came in because this was cannabis. It was a group therapy, and it was a bunch of people that use cannabis. So I just felt I wasn't going to be as judged as heavy for having, in my eyes, gone down this kind of downward spiral and hit rock bottom. So, that the shame that I felt around normal veterans groups, for whatever reason, he said, I just thought it wasn't as bad. I just didn't feel as shameful around, people who weren't going to be as judgmental. Who might have had similar issues too. And that's the only, he's like, this is the only reason I'm alive today. He's like, I reunited with my daughter. I've got housing. I've got a job now, haven't touched anything, or any kind of opiates in like 2 years. He was honest. He said, I've gone through periods of, sobriety. This has been a lot easier with the cannabis, because if I ever suddenly get just this an overwhelming urge to take an opiate and just get zonked out, I can just go grab this, really, really strong indica and take a few puffs of that. And that, mitigates that feeling completely. So I see a place down there like high sobriety, which sounds kind of silly. And, as this harm reduction model where it allows it's a residential treatment facility, which allows folks to utilize cannabis while there. And again, it's still pretty early, but I guarantee you the data that's going to come out of that, I'm excited to see the data because I really believe that it's going to show very high or very low rates of relapse and recidivism, whatever the term is for falling back under the spell of opiates.
That's definitely interesting. It'll be interesting to see how that plays a role as far as recovery goes, because there's so many, if you're in an AA or a program, a lot of times, if you take cannabis, you're out of the program. Yeah. You're done. And we've got to end in a little bit, but I want to ask you a couple more questions. Mm-hmm. The first is this, and this is kind of switching gears, but as an amputee, what are you doing right now to stay in shape? I know fitness is extremely important.
Yeah.
But what are you doing right now to stay in top shape and to exercise? Mm-hmm.
So again, plus being a startup founder, it's pretty busy, and I oftentimes have to be very flexible with my schedule. I'm fortunate enough to live by a Coast Guard base, and I love the Coast Guard because they have bases, you know, all in major cities, and they all have amazing gyms and usually pretty good PXs, and they're completely underutilized. So I go to my local gym now, and fortunately they have a CrossFit room. So I'll do my own kind of CrossFit programming. I wish and look forward to the time when I can both afford and have the time and better structure to join a gym again, because you know you can never beat training with other people and getting the competitiveness in there. But yeah, I keep pretty active. I do it. It's probably like half CrossFit, half traditional. Like focusing on one body part a day, things like that. And I have to be honest, I 2016 was a low fitness year for me, because I had a bunch of the problem with my leg is every once in a while, even if I take really good care of it, you know, shit happens and a wound will develop, or you know, I have some weird stuff now, or I'm actually being a lot better about staying on top of it than in the past with certain potential wounds on my leg. But I've got like a scar that's starting to get funky, that it's weird. It's like converting into like a belly button looking thing. So I am from like a almost flat scar. So, you know, I'm going to have to get that removed. So I'll be out of the leg for a few weeks, which is going to kind of stink. But yeah, in general, I try to do CrossFit just because I personally love throwing weights around, and you know, I have legs right now. My legs are not ideal. Going back to the conversation we had before we got on air, in order to get really, really good care from the VA, but you got to be a professional patient. And that's the same thing with my prosthetics. Like I'm looking at my running leg right now, and you want the truth? I haven't worn it in about a year, and I don't think I could actually wear it. I think it doesn't fit. If it fits, I'd probably go for a run and then regret it afterwards for the next day or two. So these are things once my kind of schedule, and I it's something I haven't been good about is you know, self-care in a sense, and self-care a lot of times it's not where you think. It's not just taking a day off for me or doing things like that. It's actually just sometimes actually having to work harder or do more because of your health. So what I have to start doing is, instead of saying, oh, you know, my leg's bothering me, I'm just going to kind of take it easy today, is to say, okay, instead of taking it easy, I'm going to go to the doctor, and yeah, it kind of sucks. And we're all, you know, go through, fill all this paperwork or make all these appointments to go see folks at the VA. But I know that, you know, in the long run, it's a lot more valuable than just kind of sitting back and passively hoping, things fix themselves.
And then, you know, like I said, everybody has those types of issues. I think, you know, I'm running our business. I run into that all the time. I find that at the end of the day, sometimes it really, really helps with my mental wellness.
Working out. Working out?
Yeah, getting outside or getting in the gym and getting your heart rate up. Just, you know, it allows everything to kind of just shed. Mm-hmm.
Well, again, you're pumping your body full of all these other, you know, you're pumping your body full of endocannabinoids, you're pumping it full of all kinds of other, you know, positives. And that's why I like CrossFit, is because I like to do something where I get that, you know, that kind of rebound where, you know, you get the workout hurts, but then you get that kind of rebound, kind of like positive, what is it? The good feeling, one of the good feeling chemicals that's running through your body. And the fact too, that as you know, you're just to be able to get a really, really good sweat, is good for everybody, just sweating out toxins. But me, especially for my leg, believe it or not, one of the problems, when not working out is it compounds itself. Cause the less I work out, the less I'm actually stressing the skin minorly, but more importantly, the less I'm actually sweating through my leg, because it sweats a lot, you know, being that it's completely kind of colluded and covered with you know, it's like kind of a heavy silicone kind of sleeve that you wear around it. And that actually is really good for the skin. It helps keep it, helps keep the toxins out. It helps keep the skin supple and things like that. So yeah, I actually have to work out, to maintain decent physical condition. I mean, not just maintain physical fitness, but just to maintain my health. Like I really need to put a focus on working out. So again, just like the self-care, you know, I'll do that. I've noticed as I get a little bit older, I'm not as excited to, if I haven't worked out in a couple of days or a week or so, it's always hard to get back there that first day. But as soon as I get back there that first day, then the next day is easier. And the day after that's even easier. It's so.
And then, the other thing I wanted to just touch on, is, you know, you've gone through these different stages in life, you know, from West Point to U.S. Army officer to wounded veteran to now entrepreneur. What types of advice do you have for those guys who might be out there listening to this, who are kind of wondering where they're going to go? What's the next step for
them? Oh man, that's always it's always a good question. Even though I kind of you know, I'm sure the answer is kind of there in that long meandering background of or the life story I gave you. I think right off the bat, you absolutely have to find some kind of close peer group, and a healthy one too, not an unhealthy one, but people that are, in general, positive people, and people that are, you know, ideally it's something that is, it's social, not just within that group, but, you know, you're doing kind of bigger social activities. Because what we really need first and foremost, I think, as veterans, is some kind of tribal identity even if it's not, you know, in society, but even just a small group with very well-defined norms. So if people find this at CrossFit, people find this in churches, people find this, in many different places out there, is to find some kind of group that, again, has shared values and norms that you appreciate and that is a positive and socially, you know, external to them, just their own little group, externally social group, if that makes sense. I mean, I'm trying to figure out a better way to kind of say that.
No, it makes sense. The tribe thing is so important. That's a theme that's continually come up here on this podcast. We were talking to Keith Norris, the founder of Paleo FX, yesterday, and he was talking about the importance of tribes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have Sebastian Younger's book that came out, I think it was a couple of years ago it came out, but
that was a powerful book. I read that book, and I mean, the great thing about that book, you can read in one sitting, and it's very powerful, and it really opened my eyes to a lot. I think most veterans a lot of the things that I was feeling, that book really helped me understand. So I recommend that to every single transitioning veteran, actually. Another thing too is educate yourself, take a broad education, challenge your existing viewpoints on stuff. I mean, that's going to be huge in order to spread cannabis, is folks being able to step back, and somehow remove all those years of misinformation, frankly, that's been crammed into their head, into their ego, into their id, and just being able, in general, if you're able to, I have not been able to do this without, you know, help from other substances, but to actually be able to pull out of your ego and stop seeing yourself I'm a male, I'm a white guy, I'm a Army veteran, I play football, and just try to see look at an issue as just a pure being of rational thought, because that's going to give you the most kind of most objective view of something. And I think that is an issue that a lot of people in general have, is that they're not able to get outside their own head, outside their own ego, and outside their own id, and actually examine and question, you know, their existing beliefs on something and challenge themselves. And don't be afraid. The biggest thing, it's one of the scariest things. And again, this is why I see a lot of veterans coming around on a lot of issues, is because the average person, you know, is oftentimes afraid. I mean, it's people aren't honest with themselves, not just because of complacency or because they're lazy, even though that's the reason. It's because they're just really afraid of what they're going to see if they are truly honest with themselves. But the great thing about being a veteran and being somebody who has you know, kind of moral and personal courage ingrained through your service is why I think we're exceptionally qualified to actually be able to, if we give ourselves a chance to be afraid, is to look at, you know, kind of our worldview and the existing issues and objectively say, okay, does this actually make sense or not? And if people did that with cannabis, I think very quickly, you know, we talked about how safe it is. We talked about all its benefits. There's very little, all these positive externalities, opiates going down, car crash. So my theory, and people in cannabis aren't going to like that, is I think car accidents might actually go up in states with access slightly. And there's some data that said like a 3% raise, but the rate of fatal car accidents goes down by 20-25%. And that just from anecdotally, you know, seeing how cannabis affects people kind of makes sense. But yeah, I really just being not afraid to just working up the courage to actually question your beliefs and allow yourself to fully think through, you know, why you believe that and why that should be the way it is. And sometimes you're going to get to the end of this exercise and be like, okay, you know what? I was right. I feel I'm confident. I'm 100% right in thinking that way. And then what's going to happen too is when you do defend that position, I think it's going to come out a lot more legitimate. And then you have a better chance of actually influencing others when you really, really at your core believe what you're saying.
Absolutely. Well, Ryan, I want to thank you for coming on today and taking us through your journey from, you know, being a cadet all the way through being a wounded veteran and on into what you're doing now. You know, for those of you at home who listen to this, I think that's some good advice right there. Mm-hmm. Look at your beliefs, question things, get out there into the world and form your opinions, at least try to form your opinions off of objective observation of what's going on. And the more we can do that, the better off we're all going to be. So for everybody out there, and Ryan, stay on after I click this off, but for everybody out there, thank you for listening to this and get out there and live your best life.
I want to thank you for listening to episode number 48 with Ryan Miller. I think it was a great episode and particularly helpful for those of you who may be going through your own stages of life or who may be looking to seek alternative medicines outside of the VA system that are now rapidly becoming legal and very, very helpful for reducing total body chronic inflammation and increasing health. Another thing that's really helpful for increasing health is fitness. And Warrior Soul has its own line of fitness courses, one of which is Warrior Soul Keto Camp. And we're offering a special right now that includes both Warrior Soul Keto Camp and membership in the Warrior Soul Agoji. And if you sign up for these, you also get into our foundational course, Warrior Soul Fitness. Now, most training programs just give you a nutrition plan and a training plan, and they tell you, hey, you know what, go at it yourself, and that's that. With this, we teach you how to optimize your hormones, how to optimize your digestion. We teach you mental hacks to increase your productivity. We teach you how to integrate this whole program into your lifestyle, which I think is the real key to success. So if you're interested in increasing your fitness or increasing your knowledge about fitness, head over to www.warriorsoulketocamp.com and you will gain access to one of the best fitness courses on the planet right now. That's Warrior Soul Keto Camp's foundational package. So with that, I hope you enjoyed this episode and we will talk to you very soon. This is Chris, out.